So welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. What's not on BCFM? It's not BCFM's Politics Show. We're promised that maybe we'll be back. Well, it's not a promise, is it? BCFM's manager, Pat Hart, who took us off the air, even though we were able perfectly easily to go online and do it back in March, apparently because he was worried about Ofcom complaints, said we may be back in November, but we're not holding our breath, that's for sure. We get stuck in this week to untangle the lies and ask the questions that don't seem to have occurred to the muzzled mass media journalists, like flaccid Fiona Bruce running her antiques roadshow version of Thursday night's BBC Question Time, a programme that used to be a serious political debate show, as their editors and the producers gag the mouths of professors, doctors and other experts who don't agree with the pharmaceutical industry lobby. We're also looking at the fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh tonight and analyse that. I would say when the BBC World Service did a forum programme on that today, and I think we've actually, I mean, I was amazed to hear they got four or five experts on there and some more people too, but they didn't actually get to the core of what it's about. How did the BBC manage that with all those resources at the World Service? Ritula Shah is very good, but she just doesn't have the right people on. There are people who have got an axe to grind of some sort, or they just don't know what's going on. Well, anyway, we get to the bottom of that tonight with Marcus Papadopoulos. And we will also look at the week's COVID plandemic developments, including introducing the term Rona scam with single mum Julie Beale, who's been looking into the different types of so-called panacea. That is the vaccines, supposedly the vaccines, but she doesn't call them that. She calls them the Rona vaxes. Also, Richard Madeley has said that the government response is sheer madness and explains why, as well as the mayor of Middlesbrough is an open defiance of Boris Johnson, saying he refuses to implement draconian measures in his town. Absolute refused yesterday. And he was on The World at One yesterday, and you can have a listen back to that, and suddenly he got cut off. He managed to say about two words, and that was it. What would our mayor say? Marvin Rees, the right-wing Labour, in big inverted commas, mayor. What would he say? No prizes for guessing. As well as in Hong Kong, a virologist that says she has evidence that the COVID-19 was definitely man-made at China's Wuhan lab, because she worked on it herself. So, Martin, on to our weekly corona battle, you and I, between those that think that it is necessary to lock the entire nation down and those that don't. Again, this is a sort of defining thing, really, a bit like the Assange case. But I think we should probably start, really, with Donald Trump this morning with the amazing announcement that he has actually tested positive. But, of course, the whole idea of testing positive, what does it really mean?
He's in his 70s and was classified as obese at his last health check. Financial markets around the world fell after the president tweeted that he and his wife Melania had COVID-19. Mr. Trump had earlier told Fox News he was going into quarantine after his advisor, Hope Hicks, who travelled with him on Air Force One, had tested positive herself.
I just went for a test, and we'll see what happens. I mean, who knows? But you know Hope very well. She's fantastic, and she's done a great job. But it's very, very hard when you are with people from the military or for law enforcement, and they come over to you, and they want to hug you, and they want to kiss you, because we really have done a good job for them. And you get close, and things happen. I was surprised to hear with Hope, but she's a very warm person with them, and she knows there's a risk.
Mika Mosbacher is an advisor to the Trump 2020 campaign. She told us the president was feeling well.
He's a warrior and a fighter, and we do not anticipate at this point that he will become incapacitated. He's got more energy than two 30-year-olds. You just went through this a few months ago with your leader, Boris Johnson. It is obviously a hideous disease, and many people have lost their lives. But fortunately, in this situation, the president is not even feeling symptoms.
So, president's not feeling symptoms, but he's tested positive. The obvious question here, Martin, is where did he catch it?
Well, I mean, they're claiming that it's Hope Hicks that passed it to him, because she got ill, and then she tested positive, and of course she'd had lots to do with him. She's very close to Trump. So then he was tested and he's found to be positive.
I mean, is it possible that the powers that be might actually just you know, make sure that people like Boris and Trump get contaminated with COVID at a certain point, which is politically suitable for them.
Well, I'm looking at the internet today, and there's plenty of people who are, floating these kind of ideas. I presume that there is some objective basis on which they carry out these tests, and that it's not all made up, but you never know.
Apparently, Hope Hicks is an obsessive mask wearer, which some people would say is a very good thing. Even wears it when she's just walking down the street, which, you know, they're not obliged to do that sort of thing, and in restaurants and things like that. So it does rather prove that the mask doesn't stop you getting COVID.
Well, I think that's a non sequitur. I mean, she's got COVID, and so has he. How they got it, we don't really know. They'll probably presumably be they have to go around and track and trace all the people that have been in contact.
It does rather justify this whole thing of the original World Health Organization rules about masks that said that actually they don't think masks are a good idea at all because they don't stop you getting the virus. Well, it's proved pretty much that that's the case with Hope. What about where he caught it? I mean, is that just a couple of days after he did the presidential debate, Martin? So there was Trump wandering around in the TV studios or whatever, and he caught it there.
Well, I don't know, Tony, any more than you do, but I presume what's going on is they're tracking and tracing all the people he's been in contact with and Hope Hicks has been in contact with, and they'll be trying to find out who's got it and how far it's spread. But it's not hardly surprising because Trump basically, from the get-go, has taken a bit like Boris Johnson saying, "I've just shaken hands with coronavirus I haven't got it."
Isn't he a terrible person, etc. But it doesn't seem like, so far anyway, that there's they're saying he's totally asymptomatic, and Melania too.
Well, no doubt, Joe Biden.
Maybe it's a false positive.
Joe Biden.
It's not a false negative, is it? Maybe it's a false positive test.
Joe Biden has said he wishes him a speedy recovery. And it may well be that he will have no symptoms and have a speedy recovery. Or he may have a brush with death like Boris Johnson. Or, given that he's 74 and overweight, he might die. And that'll put a cat among the pigeons, wouldn't it?
Well, he's actually got a fairly good chance of survival, hasn't he, even at his age?
Well, we shall see.
If you're over 80, then it does start to go up.
We shall see. It may be because Biden was in the same room with him, and and all the rest of it. They could both be tested positive.
This is just a few minutes ago. BBC have announced Trump does have mild symptoms. So
that's how Boris started off, and then he went to intensive care.
And Trump's chief of staff said the president was on the job and in good spirits, adding he expected him to make a quick recovery, his chief of staff says. The news comes just after a month before presidential elections, where we'll face a Democratic challenger, Joe Biden. Well, the obvious thing to ask here is, could this affect the actual running of the election?
Well, it could. I mean, obviously, the effects that it may have. What happened with Boris Johnson when he got ill is he got a bump of support in the opinion polls. So, that may work play in Trump's favour, or it may not. If he gets seriously ill, it may play in his favour, but it also tends to undermine his narrative that he said the other week hardly anybody has got it. I mean, he's come out with some pretty confused. That's putting not too fine a point on it. Some fairly confused statements about what's going on, and it's possible that the implications of this, if he were to die, for example, that would throw the whole election into chaos, and I don't know what would happen. I was joking with Dave here earlier that maybe both Biden and Trump could die because they're both in the age range where they might. And then what are they going to do? And there's all sorts of question marks about the election, as you know, all there's controversy about the rules of the election and all the rest of it.
Anyone that catches COVID might die, but, let's wish him a speedy recovery like everybody else. My theory is that he caught it here. So let's have a listen to the US debate, for our first of two clips from that this week, the US presidential debate. I was listening out for anything about foreign policy, Martin, nothing on this one at all domestic policy, but here they talk about the vaccine.
You have repeatedly either contradicted or been at odds with some of your government's own top scientists. The week before last, the head of the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Redfield, said it would be summer before the vaccine would become generally available to the public. You said that he was confused and mistaken. Those were your two words.
Yeah.
But Dr. Slowey, the head of your Operation Warp Speed, has said exactly the same thing. Are they both wrong?
Well, I've spoken to the companies, and we can have it a lot sooner. It's a very political thing, because people like this would rather make it political than save lives.
God.
It is a very political thing. I've spoken to Pfizer. I've spoken to all of the people that you have to speak to. We have great Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and others. They can go faster than that by a lot. Become very political, because the left, or I don't know if
the head of your Operation Warp Speed, Dr. Slowey?
I disagree with him. Yeah. No, I disagree with both of them. And he didn't say that. He said it could be there, but it could also be much sooner. I had him in my office two days ago.
He talked about the summer, sir, before it's generally available.
It's a possibility that we'll have the answer before November 1st. It could also be after
that. It's generally available.
We're going to deliver it right away. We have the military all set up. Logistically, they're all set up. We have our military that delivers soldiers, and they can do 200,000 a day. They're going to be
delivering.
This
is the same man
it's
who
all
told
set
you
up.
By Easter, this would be gone away. By the warm weather, it'd be gone. Miraculous. Like a miracle. And by the way, maybe you could inject some bleach in your arm, and that would take care of it. This is the
that
same man.
That was said sarcastically,
And so here's the deal. This man is talking about a vaccine. Every serious company is talking about maybe having a vaccine done by the end of the year. But the distribution of that vaccine will not occur until sometime beginning or the middle of next year to get it out, if we get the vaccine. And pray God we will.
Mr. Vice President, I want to pick up the...
You'll have the vaccine soon.
So there's Trump finishing up, he's saying we'll have the vaccine sooner than that. And he is in a position to know, but then he's also talking all this up, Martin, for the election, isn't he? It's very interesting the way that this whole COVID experience, this plandemic, is affecting the elections in the United States.
It is, and of course, the bad news for the anti-vaxxers, as it were, is that both Biden and Trump are boasting about how quickly they're going to get a vaccine. So there's no real acceptance of the RFK analysis of the vaccines are going to be.
No, this word anti-vaxxer is a smear, though, isn't it? I mean, it's saying that it is a smear, because it's trying to lump all together everyone that criticises vaccines as some kind of nutcase.
Yeah, well, but Trump...
Actually, there's perfectly legitimate
There are different views about this, as you know, but Trump there is basically saying there is going to be a vaccine. I've been speaking to the pharmaceutical companies which are being demonised here, and they've certainly deserved demonisation. But Trump is basically saying, I've been speaking to them, we're going to have a vaccine, I'm going to bring
the
vaccine.
He wants one for his election, doesn't
he? He wants one to help him get elected.
2 or 3 days before the presidential
election. It's getting a bit late now, isn't it? Let's face it, there's only a few weeks to go now, and it's not likely that he's going to get one before the election.
The real impact of this is going to be felt. I mean, the people who really know what's going on are the stock markets. And in the United States, there's been hardly any change. It's been just US shares drop, but not a great deal. The main three Americans' main indices, Dow Jones, S&P 500, and the Nasdaq, fell between 1% and 2.2% when trading began. There was some nervousness that it was going to collapse, but obviously it didn't. So that tells me that the markets know that the financial intelligence networks, the banksters, know that that Trump is unlikely to die of this.
Well, I mean, the point is that they're not. That one of the things that it certainly affected the markets that he got COVID, but I mean, the market sentiment can be affected by all sorts of things. Don't forget, underpinning all of this is BlackRock, who are basically shoveling taxpayer resources into the banks and into the stock market, so that the minority of the population who own shares are basically making out like bandits, while everybody else is being thrown out of work and out of their houses. But of course, it's nothing to do with the free market. It's a rigged game. Of course, it is.
And the next clip, final clip we've got from the US debate this week, where I think Trump probably caught his virus, is the green issues. And this is one of the things that the two of them really do lock horns on.
Building 1.5 million energy efficient homes. So the question becomes, the president is saying, I think some people who support the president would say that sounds like it's going to cost a lot of money and hurt the economy.
What it's going to do is going to create thousands and millions of jobs, good paying jobs.
Let him finish, sir.
He doesn't know how to do that.
$100 billion.
The fact is, it's going to create millions of good-paying jobs, and these tax incentives to people for people to weatherize, which he wants to get rid of, it's going to make the economy much safer. Look how much we're paying now to deal with the hurricanes. By the way, he has an answer for hurricanes. He said maybe we should drop a nuclear weapon on them.
I never said that.
That's
at all.
He did say.
You made it up.
And here's the deal.
You make up a
We are going to be in a position where we can create hard, good jobs by making sure the environment is clean and we all are in better shape. We spend billions of dollars now, on floods, hurricanes, rising seas. We're in real trouble. Look what's happened just in the Midwest with these storms that come through and wipe out entire sections and counties in Iowa. They didn't happen before. They're because of global warming. We make up 15% of the world's problem. But the rest of the world, we've got to get them to come along. That's why we have to get back into the Paris Accord.
All right, gentlemen.
Wait a minute, Chris. So why didn't he do it for 47 years? You were vice president. Why didn't you get the world? China sends up real dirt into the air. Russia does. India does. They all do. We're supposed to be good. And by the way, he made a couple of statements. The Green New Deal is $100 trillion.
That is not my plan.
That's
New Deal is not my plan.
I want to rebuild
If he knew anything about it.
He made a statement about the military. He said I said something about the military. He and his friends made it up, and then they went with it. I never said it.
Okay.
That is
what
not
he
true.
Did, sir, he you're said, done in this segment.
He called
Mr.
the military
Mr. Vice
stupid
President.
Bastards.
I did
he said
not
it on tape. He said
Mr.
stupid
Mr.
bastards.
Please, not sir,
said it.
Stop.
I would never say
I would
that.
Play
to
stop.
Well, you can see what kind of thing it was. I mean, I didn't see much good coverage of it, and I think you would have had to have sat up in the middle of the night and watched it yourself in order to get some any kind of sense out of it. Martin, it's a bit of a theatrical performance, and it's not a democracy really at all.
Well, I mean, I've read about it, and I've heard what people are saying about it. I mean, you have to have debates.
What do you make of what you just heard then?
Well, it's basically that both sides are trying to establish their credentials. Biden's trying to establish his credentials as somebody who's concerned about the environment. And also, because it was reported that Trump said, can't we put a nuclear weapon on a hurricane? And, that's what somebody who worked with him said. And, of course, he then denied that he'd said it. He did say that people should inject bleach. I don't know where he got that from.
Well, as he just explained there, it was an ironic comment.
Well, yes.
I mean, we reported that at the time. And of course he doesn't think that people should be, nobody sensible
well, I mean,
thinks
the
that.
This is
an attempt to smear Trump.
Yes, well.
And you're doing it too.
But Trump smears himself. I mean, he gets up in the middle of the night and tweets stuff in capitals all the time. And a lot of his base like that. They like the fact that he used the word stupid.
Well,
it's
better than the secrecy, isn't it?
Well, what you see.
Running your country like a cult.
You can't do that. Yeah, well, what you see is what you get with Trump, isn't it? I mean, some people obviously like it. He's definitely got some political support. Whether it's enough to win the election.
But anyway, I thought Biden did reasonably well, actually. I was thinking, because he's called Sleepy Joe, isn't he? And he is very, very sleepy. He doesn't seem to be able to function without an auto cue, but he managed it then. Now, there was some conspiracy theory that he was supposedly had a wire. What do you make of that?
Well, I did see that, and I was discussing this with somebody earlier, and I think the problem with Biden is basically, he's suffering from mild senile dementia, possibly even more than mild. But I can't see if somebody in that.
Why have the Democrats put him forward?
Because he's the least worst option. They didn't want Bernie Sanders because Wall Street wouldn't accept Bernie Sanders.
What about Tulsi?
She's far too left wing and too young and all the rest of it.
I mean, too sensible.
Well, yeah, basically the whole thing is a stitch up. The US political system is not a full democracy. It just isn't. There's all sorts of undemocratic features in it, including having two official parties. It's the only country in the world that has two official parties. Anybody can set up a political party in other parts of the world, and there are various different political parties in every political system. But in the US, the system is a one-party, two-party system. In other words, you can only function through the official channels. You're not allowed to, you've got no chance. And of course, the first past the post system means that the people with less votes often win, which of course is totally undemocratic, but there it is. The Senate has two representatives for every state, so that rural conservative states are massively overrepresented in the Senate, which then leads to a situation where they then decide who can be on the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court is far more conservative than the average person. And the whole thing is rigged, and it was deliberately designed to be rigged by the Founding Fathers to keep oligarchs in power. That's what it was designed to do. It's a Roman-style system rather than an Athenian-style system. And that's what it is. And basically, Joe Biden is acceptable to Wall Street. That's why he's got the nomination. And that's the reality of it.
Okay, so let's move over to the UK now to look at Britain. And I noticed this week's Private Eye, cover says a second wave coming, a picture of Boris at number 10 on the left saying hello, with Boris waving, and another one on the right, him saying goodbye, also waving. It's the first wave and the second wave is goodbye, yeah? So first wave is hello, second wave is goodbye. Private Eye are absolutely appalling ever since they got rid of Richard Ingram's and Ian Hislop took over, because they're controlled opposition basically, but they are in the know. And I would say, Martin, this is a sort of hint really that Private Eye are doing here, that Boris could be out by Christmas.
Oh, that's openly being talked about. I mean, basically what I think is going on is they're going to let him blunder around and take the flak for everything going down the drain over COVID and Brexit. And then when he walks away, they're hoping that they can then reboot themselves with Rishi Sunak, who sees him, who's definitely on manoeuvres. And he wants to be Prime Minister, it's pretty clear.
Okay, well, we'll be, you know, delving into the UK COVID stuff now, and we'll start with last weekend on Talk Radio with the Richard and Judy, the one of those, Richard Madeley. He had all sorts of trouble. We were listening to it at home, and we're trying to get hold of Richard Madeley, the line's gone down, we can't get hold of him, we've had technical problems, blah, blah, and eventually he came through and he had this to say.
It is becoming absolutely evident to anybody with a pulse that we're not going to defeat this virus by running away from it. We are playing this mad game of hide-and-seek where basically we dive under the bedclothes and sort of tremble there for 1 week, 2 weeks, whether you're in isolation for 2 weeks or 3 months in lockdown, and we come out sort of half expecting the virus to have gone away. Well, it's not going. It's here to stay, in exactly the same way as flu viruses and the cold virus and many other diseases and illnesses, part of our human existence. This is a new one, and it's come as a bit of a shock, and it's not a very pleasant one, but it's not the Black Death. The vast majority of people who get this virus will either not know that they've had it, unless they have a test, or they'll have extremely minor symptoms. And I know that there are tragic cases where people die from it and have very long-lasting effects, but they are in a tiny minority. And just taking this kind of group head-in-the-sand attitude and then lifting our heads out of the sand and somehow for everything to be all right again is crazy. It's perfectly obvious to anybody that every time we go back to a semi-normal existence after locking ourselves away as a nation for a while, cases are going to rise again, whether we test for them or not. Of course they are. That's in the nature of viruses. And I don't think there's any example in the history of the world, going all the way back to written records, where isolation and quarantine gets rid of a virus or is a long-term solution to it. It's always a very, very short-term response. And in our case, it's becoming a long-term response, and it is insane. You can make lots of metaphors for this. Hide-and-seek is one of them. Here's another one. It's as if we've had another nasty spate of accidents, say, over Christmas on the road. Deaths have spiked on the road, and everybody's told to park their car on the drive and not drive for 2 months. Yes, accident rates will drop, accident rates will fall away, but the moment everybody's allowed to get back in their cars again, accidents will start to happen again. And accidents, road accidents, are part of the risk that we accept for living on this planet in the way that we do.
Yeah.
We haven't even touched upon the risks of lockdown, of isolation. I mean, there's a report, I've only had access to one or two national UK papers this morning, but I've looked at the Telegraph, and there's a report in the Telegraph that says that a formal report was laid before SAID back in June or July that predicted that around 70,000 people would die, not as a result of COVID, but as a result of the restrictions that we're placing on society. And we know this is happening. People are having heart attacks and dying at home because they're frightened to go to hospital.
Terrified to go to hospital, yeah.
People are dying. I have somebody I know, an acquaintance of a friend of mine, who's just been diagnosed, and I'm not making this up, but this is yesterday, who's just been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And it's quite possible that one of the reasons that cancer is terminal is because he was declined treatment because of COVID for 3 months during lockdown. So for 3 months, he didn't have the chemotherapy or possibly the surgery that he clearly needed. 12 weeks have gone by and more, and he's now in final stage cancer. Now, it's impossible to prove that it was a result of not being treated, but it's very likely. And, you know, locking everybody up for weeks at a time or 2 weeks of isolation is actually causing deaths from other causes. And we have to face up to that and strike a balance. And excuse me, I seem to remember that the reason that we all rather grumpily, but in good order, agreed back in March to lockdown, and it ended up being 3 months of lockdown, was to, and I quote, protect the NHS. And what was meant by that was protecting beds and services and treatments for everybody, not just people with COVID, but for people with other conditions who, if we didn't do something, might find that they couldn't be treated because the wards were overflowing. The wards never did overflow. We built the Nightingale hospitals, which were barely used. There was plenty of capacity. The lockdown certainly into the NHS, and yet people were still not being treated when there were beds available because of, as you say, of COVID. It's illogical. It makes no sense. If I'm dying because my circulatory system is failing, my heart is failing, I'm just as much at risk, if not more, of death from that as I would be potentially from catching COVID. I don't know what's happened to us. I was looking at the news this morning and seeing what happened in Manchester now. Mm. With all of these poor students who've just arrived, you know, to begin this incredibly important phase in their lives, and they've been put straight into house arrest for 2 weeks, because that's what it is. Yeah. I don't know how that's going to work. I don't know how they're going to get food and supplies and stuff to them, but anyway, I suppose logistically they'll manage. But what a start, and how incredibly, insanely, depressingly predictable. What do people think is going to happen if you get hundreds and thousands of students locked together in an environment off campus? Are they not going to infect each other? Yeah. Of course they are.
Yeah.
And actually, they're the group, or one of the groups, least at risk if they do, in fact, contract the virus. The chances of even displaying symptoms, if you're in your teens or 20s, are very low. And the chances of becoming seriously ill or dying are vanishingly small. They're in a very safe group.
So, Isa was encouraging students. She's saying, well, this is great. If students catch it, it's fantastic, because it means that we get herd immunity.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the implication of everything that he was saying there. Although what he also said was, if you release the lockdown, then it's going to come back. And of course, that's obviously true. So the logic of that is that you don't release the lockdown. And of course, in some countries, like China, for example, where they
When do you release the lockdown? Well, then, if you never release it.
Well, what you need to do is you need to jump on it straight away, which is what they did in China
and
New Zealand.
But we can't do that, Martin.
No, we can't.
I'm afraid that particular horse has bolted.
Yes, I know.
That's not a solution.
So then what Richard Madeley said is we've got to strike a balance. And the question is, what's that balance going to be then? But he didn't say what the balance was.
I would say the balance is probably what they did in Sweden, which is to say that the people are the most likely to die, most vulnerable. What we have to do is protect those until we've got herd immunity, which they've got many months ago.
No, they haven't got herd
immunity.
Yes,
they have.
No, they haven't.
Yes, they have. Oh, yes, they have. Look, when we reported here, Martin, back in roughly April, that the chief epidemiologist in Sweden said we're nearly there, back in April. So they have now.
All right, well, I've been reading things that suggest otherwise, Tony. So we're arguing about matters of fact now. The thing about the lockdown in Sweden, because there was a lockdown in Sweden, is what they said is...
No, there wasn't.
Can I just finish, please?
Can you explain why...
still can't see football matches in Sweden.
Well, that's not a lockdown.
No, it is part of a lockdown.
No, it isn't. It's some restrictions. It's not a lockdown. Right. The people can walk out of their... Martin, the people can walk out of their houses and do pretty much whatever they want, but they can't go and see a football match.
Yes, all right. And you can't meet more than 50 people. But what the guy who was in charge of it said is we're going for this lockdown light, if we can call it that, because we're going to sustain this for as long as we have to. Whereas what we've done is gone for a big lockdown because we didn't do anything in the first stages.
What, in December when we didn't even know about it? We have this argument every week, Martin. No, it's pointless. Absolutely pointless.
No.
Let me finish the sentence, please. It's absolutely pointless, right? Because you're saying that we should have done it back in December when no one even knew the virus was here.
No, we should have done it in the beginning of the year when they certainly did know.
Well, which month?
The Chinese.
Which month?
Listen.
Which day, which month
Tony,
should we have done it? When
Tony,
we didn't know it was here.
Tony, the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States
told
me...
Did the British Intelligence Services
know? Yes, they
know?
Must have known, Tony.
And so should they have locked us down?
No, because they didn't, because they wanted it to flow back over our country and the United States so they could bail the banks out. China has no COVID cases at all now. That's one quarter of humanity. Everybody's back at school. Everybody's back at work. The economy is going to show positive growth this year. They're the only economy in the whole world that's going to do that.
Can I just
because
correct?
Did the right things
can
at
I
the
just,
beginning.
Can I just correct one point, which is that Sweden does have herd immunity. Experts are saying in the Business Insider and the Daily Mail.
Business Insider?
And the Daily Mail, yeah.
Business Insider. Are they,
well,
are they,
okay,
are they
so
medical?
You don't believe it because it's come from a publication that you don't approve of.
It's a business statement. It's not a medical statement.
Business Insider has all sorts of news,
yes,
Martin.
Right.
It's supposed to inform.
All right, Tony.
Okay, should we just find out who it is that's saying this? Sweden has beaten coronavirus, it says, by refusing to shut the country down and achieving herd immunity. The Scandinavian nation is the only country in Europe not to introduce strict lockdown measures. But scientists say this may have helped it avoid a second wave as it continued to record its lowest number of cases since March.
Scientists.
So, yes, but let's find out who exactly those... Oh, it's Professor Kim Sneppen, an expert in the spread of coronavirus at the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen, said right. Sweden has beaten the pandemic.
Yes, and there's other people who say otherwise, Tony.
Okay, so who's that?
Denmark and Norway, who are comparable countries, have had a much lower death toll than in Sweden. And if you look at what's happened in the economy in Sweden, they didn't have a lockdown, but everybody stayed home anyway. So the business, in actual fact, businesses like restaurants, if they get a 10% fall
everybody
in sales,
didn't
they
stay
go
home. People didn't stay home anyway. They didn't. They mixed. In fact, people came from other countries to visit Sweden. People came from other countries to visit Sweden because they wanted to have a normal life.
What's actually happened in Sweden is they've had pretty similar knock-on GDP as Norway and Denmark, which are neighbouring countries. But they've had a much higher death rate than those two countries. But in actual fact, it hasn't done much to protect the economy. Because ultimately, what's very interesting, let's talk economics. The problem with pandemics is that whether you have a lockdown or not, it affects the people's spending patterns. So in other words, whether you have a lockdown or not, people don't go out and spend money.
What about Richard Madeley's point that he made?
Therefore, the GDP goes down.
What is about Richard Madeley's point when he's saying that the SAGE committee knew that actually having a lockdown could kill more people and probably did than the virus itself?
Well, the point of having a lockdown, I'm not in favour of lockdowns necessarily.
And also, it gives you a great excuse to kill off the National Health Service.
Strawman arguments. What you're supposed to do with something like this is exactly what New Zealand, Kerala,
Why is it a straw man argument?
No, because what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to isolate the people who are infected.
No, the people who are vulnerable, not the people who are infected.
No.
If you get the flu, we don't isolate you. You might isolate yourself.
No, in China, there are no community spreading of COVID anywhere. So everybody is back to work. The economy is picking up. Our economy is not going to pick up because COVID has now become endemic in this country
because
of the incompetence
nonsense.
Of the government.
No, absolute rubbish. The economy is not picking up because we're having all these lockdowns still. In fact, there are various Labour mayors even who are saying that they're not going to accept it because they want the economy to pick up and they don't believe there's any justification for it at all, that it's actually a fascist measure that you're supporting.
Fascist? That's a big word. Well, in China...
this is the Germans, German doctors
saying this, Martin.
The communist
measures that they adopted in China and in Kerala have actually worked. And in Taiwan, of course, Republican China, they have also had 27 deaths or something like that. Some countries have done very well in this crisis and shown that their political systems are
so
up to
the authoritarian
job.
Countries have done better than Sweden, have they?
Yes, they have.
Yeah?
They have done better than Sweden.
Why is that?
Because they basically squashed it from the get-go. And that's what they decided to do, because it is a biological weapon, quite probably, as we're going to discuss. And if it's a biological weapon, Tony, you've got to take it seriously. You can't just say, we're going to get through it with herd immunity.
Well, you can actually get through biological weapons with herd immunity.
Well, maybe so.
Yeah.
But in any case, in China, I keep coming back to this.
Especially when not a single young person has died of it, who didn't have pre-existing conditions.
All right,
I mean, that's what you need for herd immunity.
Yeah. All right, I've still come back to my fundamental point that in China, the economy is now going back to normal because they've basically squashed
And they've got
COVID.
A wonderful social credit system and a totally authoritarian government.
That's right.
And you think that would be better to have that here, do you?
No, I think Kerala in India have done very well as well, and they've got an elected communist government. So has the Republic of Taiwan. They've got an elected anti-communist government. The South Koreans have done pretty well because they squashed it because they knew what to do. What we've got in this country is a libertarian know-nothing who think that the state doesn't intervene and therefore everything will, if you just leave it to the people, they'll sort it out. Well, and of course they can't do that.
Kerala is certainly not a model state because they've just had a massive surge in COVID cases because they've been holding back, you see, and so now they've got their second wave. Well, they didn't even have a very big first wave, but they've been trying to stave off the inevitable, a bit like King Canute. Anyway, let's move on to our next clip now, and the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, blasted Boris this week for his total disregard of Parliament as he steamrolled through this renewal of the Coronavirus Act, although with quite a lot of concessions on national measures that will have to be now discussed in Parliament.
I wish to make a statement about this House's scrutiny of delegated powers during the pandemic and on the selection of amendments to the motion relating to the Coronavirus Act later today. The way in which the government has exercised its powers to make secondary legislation during this crisis has been totally unsatisfactory. All too often, important statutory instruments have been published a matter of hours before they come into force, and some explanations why important measures have come into effect before they can be laid before this House has been unconvincing and shows a total disregard for the House. The government must make greater efforts to prepare measures more quickly so that this House can debate and decide upon the most significant measures at the earliest possible point. The use of made affirmative statutory instruments under the urgency procedure gives rise to particular concern. I will give very sympathetic considerations to applications for urgent questions or emergency debates in such cases requiring ministers to come to the dispatch box to justify the use of such powers. I hope that all honourable members will have a chance to express their views through substantive, amendable motions on scrutiny of delegated powers or on the operation of the Coronavirus Act 2020 or both. But I turn now to the motion to be considered later today, which invites the House to make a narrow, binary choice as to whether the temporary provisions of the Coronavirus Act 2020 should or should not expire. Unfortunately, as it is only a 90-minute debate, as proceeding under the Act, under SO16, I am disappointed that I cannot give additional time to discuss the issues. I know some members will be disappointed. When I became Speaker, I made it clear that I would take decisions on matters relating to procedure, guided by professional advice. I have concluded, on the basis of advice that I have received, that any amendment to the motion before the House risks giving rise to uncertainty about the decision the House has taken. This then risks decisions which are rightly the responsibility of Parliament, ultimately being determined by the courts. Lack of clarity in such important matters risks undermining the rule of law. I have therefore decided not to select any of the amendments to the motion. As I hope my early comments show, I have not taken this decision lightly. I am looking to the government to remedy a situation I regard as completely unsatisfactory. I now look to the government to rebuild the trust with this House and not treat it with the contempt that it has shown.
Well, really a slap on the wrist, I suppose, for Boris. But that meant that the it was a formal debate, which wasn't as far as it could have been. But there were some people that spoke over this renewal of the Coronavirus Act. And that was the real purpose of the demonstration last Saturday in Trafalgar Square, which was broken up by riot police, was to make the point that these lockdown measures, people don't believe who came to Trafalgar Square, that they're necessary or needed. In fact, some of the people that came to Trafalgar Square don't believe that COVID-19 actually even exists, including David Icke and his son Gareth Icke. We'll be hearing from Gareth a bit later. He's talking about the rule of law there, Marty. He's saying it's no good for law to be made by statutory instruments, by the government, basically ruling by decree.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously the point he's trying to make there.
Do you think these measures whole situation with this virus justifies ruling by decree?
Well, that's what they've tried to push, is the idea that because we've got it's all happening so quickly, we can't actually tell you what we're going to be doing in advance because we don't know ourselves.
Most importantly, Martin, more important than all that, that they have refused, point blank refused, as they did over Sage until there was a court case against it, to publish the evidence that they're using to base any of these decisions on. So we're being told X, Y, and Z. It's a bit like issuing orders from a corporation, not from a democratic government. They're just saying, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. And by the way, if you ask us why, we're just going to tell you to take a running jump.
Well, it's quite possible, and I'm pretty much convinced that it is the case, that they're making decisions based on political criteria, and therefore they don't want to say what they're actually discussing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, basically they're discussing it. We know that Cummings, for example, with his great his great love of data and all the rest of it, he's doing exactly what you were talking about Marvin Rees doing earlier on, which is he's basically looking at what people are thinking and saying about the government. So they're trying to come up.
So you mean locking down cities where people are anti-government?
Yeah, well, no, what they're trying to do.
As a punishment.
No, they're trying to come up with stuff which they think will run with the public. Now, you could argue that basically what's happened here, and I don't jump down my throat, I'm just putting it forward as a potential thing that would have happened, is that they shouldn't have opened the pubs and the restaurants, and they shouldn't have encouraged people paying people with their own money to go out to them, and that they locked down too late, and then they opened up too early, and now they're back where they started, and they don't know what to do. That's pretty much how it looks to me.
So why is it not a good idea to be having these regulated environments where people are not getting close to each other, not contaminating each other? Because, of course, if you shut those venues, you get things like happening regularly now, which is where students and others just get together, but they're not doing it in a regulated environment.
Well, I mean, I think the idea of closing pubs at 10 o'clock, I mean, that's pretty clearly not worked. I don't know where that came from. It's as if the coronavirus just goes to bed at 10 o'clock, and therefore, we don't need to, and of course everybody's been turning out of the pub
exactly
the same time.
Martin, isn't this much more to do with creating a hostile environment so that when a vaccine comes along, that everyone will go, oh, thank God, I'm going to get a vaccine and I can go back to normal?
Well, I think there's some people who are saying that, Tony, as you well know, and we're going to hear from Gareth Icke shortly, I believe. But, I mean, the point about this is what's clearly coming across to me, looking at what the government have done in this crisis, is that they're lurching from one thing to another, yeah. And that they frankly don't know what they're doing, so that they locked down, but they didn't. First of all, they were going to go for herd immunity, and they weren't going to
test and
trace.
Okay, let me just ask you another
then they
question.
Changed their mind, then they changed their mind, then changed
I know
their
what
mind.
You're saying.
You know,
okay,
they go,
let's
go back to work. No, don't go back to work.
Yes, Martin.
I mean, that's
we know
clearly,
what you're saying.
Clearly,
you've said this many
rubbish,
times.
Isn't it?
But what about the reason? Why do you think it is that Wales and Scotland seem to have had some of the strictest measures in the country, and England less so?
Well, because there's a different politics in the different countries.
Like Labour in Wales, for example.
Yeah, well, Labour in Wales and the SNP in Scotland.
They like lockdowns.
They have been more.
The whole of the valley.
They've been
much
more prepared to take strong government intervention measures. What you've got in the Tory party is a substantial chunk of the Tory party do not like the idea of government taking control of anything.
But if you look at the webcams on the M4, you know, there's no shortage of cars. It's just as busy as ever on the, which I did the other day, just as busy as ever in the South Wales motorway system. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions where the Wales lockdowns were discussed, and this whole of South Wales pretty much locked down now, including areas of North Wales too, but Mid Wales, rural Wales, is not.
Let's have all numbers.
Diolch yn fawr, Gareth. From tomorrow, 2.3 million people in Wales won't be able to travel out of county without good reason. Yet people from lockdown areas in England can still visit rural Wales. Travelling from Betws y Coed to Begelet could land you with a fine, but Rochdale to Rosnagar, no problem. Now, I raised this with the Prime Minister last week. Leisure travel from lockdown areas has got to stop. Will he make good on this today?
I'm grateful to the Right Honourable Lady. There are different measures in place, as we've discussed already this afternoon. But overall, the UK is proceeding with the same approach, and I'm very grateful to Mark Drakeford and everybody else in the Welsh Government for the way we're working together to defeat the virus. Yes, there will be some differences, and yes, there will be some seeming illogicalities, that's inevitable in tackling a pandemic. But I'm grateful for the cooperation that she is giving.
She's saying that there shouldn't be any leisure travel allowed from these lockdown areas. Now, this is just illogical. She's obviously a Plaid Cymru MP, which she does a little bit of Welsh at the start there. But, you know, this idea that if you're in a lockdown area, you should not be allowed to, say, go up into the hills and mountains around you, near you, just sounds totally ridiculous. If you've got to stay within your area, then you're more likely to be bumping into people in an urban area in the valleys than you are if you go up for a walk on the mountain.
I think what they're trying to do is stop transmission, between different communities. So obviously there's going to be a problem when you've got university students, because in Britain, people go to university, they come from all over the country. And of course they're going to be bringing in people from different parts of the country and mixing them all together. Of course in some European countries, people tend to go to university in the towns where they grew up. So you've got less of a problem with that.
Isn't this like a kind of Project Fear too? We had last year over the Brexit, the Remainer side had Project Fear. The world's going to basically collapse if we leave the European Union. Now we've got the world's going to collapse if we don't lock down because this virus is going to kill everybody. Well, it clearly isn't. I mean, particularly when almost all the cases that we hear of are asymptomatic and no one's, very few people are actually ill. So that's, in itself is a kind of paranoia, a bit like Project Fear.
Well, you talk about Project Fear in relation to Brexit. We haven't actually done Brexit yet. When we do Brexit in January...
I thought we did it last January.
No, because we're still in the single market and all the rules apply, Tony. Mm. They won't apply from January the 1st.
So what's going to happen January the 1st then? So you're still doing this Project Fear from Project Fear 1 as well as Project Fear 2?
No, it's not Project Fear 1. All that's happened since we voted in 2016 to leave the European Union very narrowly is a massive amount of quantitative easing to protect the property prices of those who voted for Brexit. But soon enough, the game is coming from January.
Many of those people that voted for Brexit, the elderly particularly, were the ones that voted, are now dead of COVID.
Well, then it's not enough to make a difference to the result, Tony.
It probably is, actually.
No, I don't see it.
Yeah, the lack of 40,000
left. I tell you who wasn't allowed to vote on it is all the people from Britain who were living in the European Union. They weren't allowed to vote, strangely enough. But anyway, because of course it's pretty clear which way they would have voted. There is going to be a dramatic effect on the British economy of a no-deal Brexit in January. I don't think anybody who's serious looking at it thinks it's going to be anything
other. Is it going to cause a crash?
It might cause a crash.
But hang on, Martin. It was a bit of a trick question there, because you were saying that the crash, before any of this Brexit was even talked about, was due any time now.
Yes, but there may
so well... So that won't have been actually
no, well,
caused
what,
it, will it?
May well
what
happen.
Will have caused it would be the banksters in the first place in the 2008
bailout. And of course that then led to the discontent, which led to Brexit. Brexit will have its own impact.
So it could
the
cause
pound is
the
already
crash.
Drifting down
so what I'm saying, it'd be
as
like
a result
the, it,
of...
The crash is... The crash is waiting to happen like a giant bomb, and Brexit could be the fuse that actually lights it.
Well, it may well
something
be,
is going to light it.
It may well be the case that Britain will have a specific recession related to Brexit.
But a crash or not?
Well, it will be a crash. What will happen is you get the recession, and then, of course, people things start going bust, and that then causes the crash. I mean, it's a fool's game to try and to guess all this, because we've got COVID, and we've also got the fact that the world economy is on the edge anyway.
Prince Charles and Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum. Surely there's a positive role that they're bringing in here, because at some point we've got to get back to reality in the financial markets, haven't we?
Well, no, the Japanese have been printing using the magic money tree to keep the stock market up since the 1980s. And we could have done exactly the same thing here, but we chose not to because we had a Tory government that believed...
Is that
was
right, the right or the wrong policy, then?
Well, you haven't got a choice, actually, Tony. And Rishi Sunak's going to find this.
Well, you have
as
a choice.
As he withdraws...
Martin, you have a choice as to whether to bail your banks out or not, don't you?
Yes, and if you don't bail them out, they crash, and then capitalism comes to an end.
Well, not necessarily.
Oh, yes,
no,
I think
banks,
it does.
Really?
Yes, that's the problem. That's why they have to bail the banks out, because if they crash, the banks crash, then that's the end of capitalism.
Isn't it a form of capitalism that's basically deregulated now, where the casino economy dominates the entire country?
Indeed, and the problem with that is it's like having a suicide bomber in the room with you. Yes, you could let them blow the suicide belt up, but then you're going to die
too. Can't you lock them in a cupboard before they do
it? No, you can't. I'm afraid all these things are it's all related.
Effectively what Andrew Tyrie apparently was trying to do, which was to do what everybody was saying should be done after the 2008 crisis, which we now need legislation to, it sounds like a crazy dream now, to separate the casino economy from the real economy. And that's what they were trying to do. Of course, they didn't succeed. Whether it was ever going to be possible.
They didn't even try.
They talked about it.
It was talked about, but then the Tories won the election, if you remember, and they knocked that on the head. And that basically what's happened since then is they've basically been continuing to bail the banks out. Mark Carney, after there was a wobble in the pound and there was a wobble in the British economy after the referendum vote, and he basically switched on the money tap to protect the economy. But of course, you're not supposed to do that. The economy is supposed priced Brexit out.
They switched on the money tap at the same time as they brought in this universal credit and punished all the poorest people in the country,
yes.
Basically through things like sanctions, so they haven't even got enough money to buy toilet paper.
That's right, and because the reason they did that is because in the swing constituencies which the Tories have to win, like the Red Wall, lots of people like the idea of poor people being given a hard time. And all the focus groups were telling them, yes, they like the idea of poor people giving them a hard time. If we had PR, like in Ireland, then that wouldn't matter, because those people's votes would just count for one vote. But because they're the swing voters, their attitude towards people on benefits is punitive, and it actually wins votes and it wins elections.
So how do you think we're going to get back to any kind of normal economy where people are actually being able to actually do their jobs again? Because Keir Starmer seems to agree with you that we shouldn't be relaxing any of these measures, and that is really going to be the death knell for the economy, surely. He said what we should be doing is just bailing people out and paying people to not do anything.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the magic money tree has been found, Tony. It's quite possible to just carry on spending the money. Ultimately, that might lead to inflation, which would undermine the wealth of the wealth owners. But in actual fact, inflation in the 1970s was pretty good for ordinary people.
On
it was just rubbish for people who owned assets.
It actually all depends on whether people are actually sick and ill and dying. I mean, if you're just going to be testing positive with no symptoms, it doesn't really make any difference. You can carry on surely as normal.
Well, in the countries where they've got rid of COVID completely, like New Zealand and China, they certainly did have it in China.
Place.
That's where it started, isn't it?
Not in New Zealand. They never had it at all.
No. Well, they certainly did in China, in Wuhan. They locked the place down. They tested everybody in the city.
As I said,
and then they got rid of it.
As I said at the time, you know, there are people in New Zealand that are extremely worried, feeling that the whole idea of a complete lockdown, never having this virus in New Zealand, was like a ticking time bomb. It was all just waiting to, at some point, this virus is going to arrive, and then they're going to have to all lock down again. That could be any point in the future. And this is the tactic of the World Health Organization, if I could put it like that. The idea is that you're never going to go back to normal until you have a vaccine.
Yes, and therefore there's a question about whether there is any vaccines. The Russians have developed one already, the Sputnik 5 vaccine, but it's certainly not being developed by the big pharmaceutical companies in the West.
Let's go back to Prime Minister's questions now, where Keir Starmer reiterates his support for all these restrictions around the country.
Keir Starmer!
I support the restrictions. I've done so every single time the Prime Minister's introduced it. He well knows that. The question I've asked is, because of the restrictions, lots of people's jobs are at risk. Lots of people's jobs, 10,000 people's jobs in Newcastle in hospitality because of the restrictions. I support the restrictions. What I'm asking the Prime Minister is, can the economic support go in for those that will lose their jobs? And he didn't answer that. There's 10,000 people that wanted an answer to that last question because they're going to lose their jobs by Christmas. Prime Minister, you really should have answered it. The reality is that the Chancellor's made a political choice to reduce economic support just when the new health restrictions are coming in. If the Prime Minister doesn't accept that from me, maybe he'll listen to the following example from the Chancellor's own constituency. This is the business owner, Prime Minister. You might want to listen to what he has to say. We own a wedding venue in Richmond, North Yorkshire. The Chancellor's latest plan does nothing to help us. We can't employ people to work in events that the government are not allowing to take place. Our events team are looking in the face of redundancy, as we simply can't afford to pay wages when events are in lockdown. These jobs here are viable if only the government would allow us to return to work. My events team, he goes on to say, are talented and fantastic, and it's an insult to suggest their jobs are not worth saving. So this isn't about supporting restrictions, Prime Minister. It's about what the Prime Minister has to say to those that are at risk of losing their jobs and businesses. What, on behalf of the Chancellor, does he say to that business owner?
Prime Minister.
Well, I'm very grateful, Mr. Speaker, because I think that the answer is very clear. And I think last week the Labour Party supported the package, the winter economic plan that the Chancellor put forward. And I think that most people, looking at the £190 billion that we've invested in supporting people across this country, will recognise, which is, by the way, the furlough plan alone was far more generous, is far more generous than any other European country. I think most people around the world can see that this government is putting its arms around the people of this country, helping them through, and we will help. And I know that the wedding sector has had a particularly tough time, and I feel for the gentleman that he refers to in Richmond in Yorkshire who wants his business to go ahead. But the best way forward for him and for all other business in the country is if we all pull together now, get the virus down, keep the economy moving. And in the meantime, yes, of course, this government is able to supply the support that is needed, which, by the way, is only possible because we had a prudent, sensible, one nation conservative party in power over the last 10 years, and the Labour Party would have bankrupted the country.
Well, the options are really government support, money, or getting the economy back to normal. Isn't that just basically what this is about?
No, I think the economy's not going back to normal anyway for all sorts of reasons. Don't forget the banking system.
That's what MIT want, isn't it?
Yeah, but the banking system collapsed.
That's what Bill Gates
wants. The banking system collapsed last September.
Bill Gates doesn't want the economy going back to normal.
It's not just Bill Gates. It's not a question of what people want, Tony. It isn't going back to normal. The banking system has collapsed for the second time.
It is in an abnormal state to start with, certainly.
Yeah.
But I mean, basically, people just want to go back to work, don't they?
People want life to be straightforward, and it just isn't. And of course,
Boris is saying £190 billion he's put into the economy. Have you seen any of it?
Well, no. Well, indirectly, no doubt. But I mean, the point is that other European countries, Scandinavian countries, for example, are continuing to support businesses. I mean, Rishi Sunak basically threw the Tory textbook out of the window when this kicked in, and he decided he was in fact going to spend some money to defend people's jobs and so on. And of course, that proved that there was a magic money tree. They could have done that before. See, Boris at the end there saying we've only had the money because we had 10 years of austerity. That's rubbish. They had 10 years of austerity because the previous tranche of money went straight down the mall.
So
of the
why
bank.
Is it that the Labour Party is fanatically supporting Boris on these measures? It
no.
doesn't seem like there's any real opposition.
No, they're supporting the government on the lockdowns, but they're not supporting them on the economic policy.
So why are they not opposing the government on the lockdowns, since most people wanted the lockdowns to end?
If you look at the opinion polls, Tony, you will find that most people are still scared of catching the virus. That's the reality.
Well, that's not the same thing, though, is it? That,
no.
You know, you cannot catch the virus if you're working in a safe environment.
Yeah, but lots of people don't work in safe environments. I think you are mistaking a minority who are very unhappy with the lockdown from the general population, who are basically supportive of what the government has done in trying to control the virus. They've given them the benefit of the doubt, and they've done their best to try and follow the rules.
So you think it's okay?
They're getting very fed up with the rules constantly changing.
Well, that's right. If you think, why is there no opposition to this at all from the Labour Party? I mean, there is, obviously, amongst Labour cities. We're going to be hearing from the Mayor of Middlesbrough, Andy Preston, in a minute, but nothing from the Labour Party at all.
Well,
As
you pointed out earlier, the Welsh Labour government and the SNP have generally taken a more cautious approach to releasing lockdown than the Tories in England. And that's the bottom line where they're at.
They don't want to release them at all, really.
Well, no, and I think
they'd rather we were locked down permanently.
What you will find if you actually look at the opinion polls, Tony, is that most people are dubious about whether we should have released the lockdown after we went into it. And in fact, when we come back to write the history on this, I think what's going to be pretty clear is the lockdown too late and they released too early.
Martin, you just keep saying we locked down too late. This is a ridiculous thing to say because we didn't know that we had the coronavirus circulating in the UK in December, January, February. Mm-hmm. The only time we knew about it was March, so we didn't lock down too late. It's impossible to lock down too late.
Other countries did better than we did, including China.
That's not the same thing, is it? Anyway, let's have a listen now to Desmond Swain, because he is definitely opposing Boris, well, the Labour Party aren't, and he's a Conservative MP.
Less than a year ago, I celebrated what I thought was the election of a sceptical and liberal Conservative administration. And now I'm left wondering if the Prime Minister hasn't been abducted by Dr. Strangelove and reprogrammed by the sage over to the dark side. The purpose of politicians is to impose a measure of proportion, a sense of proportion on science, and not to be enthralled to it. Now, I will make myself very unpopular, but I believe that the appearance of the chiefs last week should have been a sacking offence. When they presented that graph, with the caveat that it wasn't a prediction. But nevertheless, it was clear that they presented it as a plausible scenario. With its 50,000 cases per day by mid-October, based on the doubling of infections by the week. Not once, not on one day since March, have there been infections on that day that were double that of the day of the week preceding. Not once. Where did this doubling come from? What was their purpose in presenting such a graph? It was the purpose of the fat boy in Pickwick Papers. I wants to make your flesh creep. It was Project Fear. It was an attempt to terrify the British people, as if they haven't been terrified enough.
So that was new Forest West MP Desmond Swain really having a go. He's saying basically Patrick Vallance should, and he's been suggesting that Patrick Vallance should be sacked. And we were talking about this last week, Martin, weren't we? Where he's £600,000 worth of shares in GlaxoSmithKline, and he's also Mr. Revolving Door. He was a former president at GlaxoSmithKline. So what we've got effectively is the industry making policy, and Labour are not calling out the government at all for this.
No, they're not. I mean,
Are Labour happy for the industry to make policy, the big pharma?
What you've got is a split within the Tory party between Cummings and Johnson,
Can you talk about the Labour Party? I'm asking you about the Labour Party. Why aren't they opposing? This is natural Labour territory.
No, it's
they
not.
Don't believe in revolving doors in the civil service. They don't believe that big business and industry should be running the country.
No, but they also believe in taking the scientific advice. And Patrick Vallance, whatever people may say about him, is the guy who's been given that job. Now, the Tory MP doesn't like what he's hearing, but that's just too bad, isn't it? He doesn't like it, but he's not going to get his way. And ultimately, the Labour Party are basically going with the centre of public opinion in the country, which is not extreme on one attitude or the other towards the coronavirus crisis. I think they're very... It's clear for anybody that say you've got to go back to work and then say, oh, please don't go back to work. Oh, go to the pub, don't go to the pub. This is driving everybody nuts. The fact is you should have stick to a thing. You should have actually had a clear policy and stuck to it from the get-go.
Well, that's
and they haven't done
probably
that.
A good idea. But when was the get-go? Back last year. Anyway, Professor Michael Levitt is a Nobel laureate. He's been chatting on Twitter. I came across him on Twitter about being bullied. He's, you know, isn't it amazing we've got this situation where someone who's a Nobel laureate has got hate mail and is having to keep blocking people all the time who are just really just abusing him online. So anyway, here he is talking about what he says, what we really need to do is control the panic.
You've had about 600 deaths so far out of 6 million. So you're about 100 deaths per million. So if you think about what we've seen in Europe, and it doesn't have to be the same everywhere, but we generally the...
He's on Sky Australia talking about Australian deaths.
Australia is not in the West. But countries that have, a relatively high standard of living, which means they have old people, You know, it looks to me like in order to Australia to reach the sort of saturation that we've seen in Sweden or almost all the rest of the Western world, and unfortunately, we're going to need to have more cases. We don't necessarily need to have more deaths, but unfortunately, it's impossible.
Isn't that the experience, Professor Levitt, from France, where deaths are cases, the infection rate's going up higher and higher, but they haven't had deaths. Deaths are extremely low.
Exactly. The whole of Europe, you know, there's been almost no increase in deaths.
Surely, Professor, that's the point, that if we're not seeing deaths, if we're not seeing excess deaths, then what is the point of, for example, in Victoria, we have the police hauling women out of cars, we have pregnant women being hounded in their homes by police officers charging in because they've posted something on Facebook.
We don't live forever. And as people get older, they become more frail, they have comorbidities. And, you know, in Europe, for example, one of the reasons why there's a belief that COVID was relatively bad in Europe is that they had very, very weak flu seasons, both in the winter of 1920 and also in the winter of 1819. The flu was much less bad than normal. So one way to see this, and you know, my analogy is not humane, but it's what I think is an easy thing to understand, is you could imagine a forest where there are some trees that are getting old, getting vulnerable, and then, you know, for a few years there's no wind or no fire. And then suddenly there's a big wind and you're going to have a lot of trees fall down at first. You have a vulnerable population, generally an older population, a population with comorbidities. But I think the general misnomer is that we think we can control this virus, you know, by strong action. And unfortunately, what we need to really do is control the panic.
What we really need to do is control the panic. He's really basically pointing the finger at the media. You know, I don't know if you remember, Martin, but when we were very first looking at Wuhan and the virus, we still had our BCFM program. There was a doctor on the BBC's Question Time when they still had a proper audience there. And certainly wasn't as farcical as it was last night. One of the doctors right at the very front in the front row said that the real problem is the media. They're getting quite good information about the virus from the government, but the media is panicking it. And of course, I know, and you know, and everyone knows that the media loves to sensationalise things. This, for them, is a great boondoggle. It's the great sensational story, and they're basically talking it up, and that is a kind of fear tactic. What Professor Michael Levitt there is saying is that the panic is being fed by the press, and we need to moderate them. We need to stop it.
Well, what we need is cool heads in relation to all of this stuff. There's an awful lot of people shouting, very strident opinions on both sides of this debate. And in actual fact, what we need is for people to just adopt a sensible tone of voice and discuss things in a rational way.
So would you give hate mail to him, you know, that chap?
I hear what he has to say, and I can see that it seems to hold up, but I listen to other people who are saying different things. And I think we've got to recognise that there's going to be different views on this, and there clearly are different views. There are different views amongst the scientists, and therefore there are very, very definitely going to be different views amongst the politicians and the public in general. I think that because what's happened really is a lot of people, having gone through the lockdown, the last thing people want is for all the sacrifices to have been for nothing, and then we just shrug our shoulders and basically allow the virus to spread.
Well, I don't
spread.
Know if you've ever come across something called the Crow House. It's done by Max Egan, and he's in Australia, out in the middle of nowhere, apparently. It was extremely popular. He's had his YouTube channel shut down, but all of his videos saved by somebody, which is rather nice of them. Anyway, he was on the Richie Allen show recently, and he's saying basically that the deep state have red-pilled the world, which I thought was quite an interesting way of putting this, saying that loads of people are now waking up to a deep state agenda, basically evil agenda by global elites, after this coronavirus outbreak. So, but actually not the virus itself, but the reaction to it by media, big pharma and governments.
I think a lot of people are waking up. I mean, they've virtually red-pilled most of the world with this. So many people have figured out that it's a scam, even though there are a lot that are going along with it. I mean, there's always going to be hope, Richie, but you've got to be prepared to have a plan B as well and realize a lot of people may not get it. You know, a lot of people may actually lead us into this, but it's not really about that anyway. Like I said, if you can look at it as a form of soul purification, it's okay for a lot of people to get led into the mainframe because if you're a divine being and you wanted to purify yourself or whatever, you wanted to get rid of the garbage, well, how would you do it? I mean, you could create a situation like this. If it is a universal consciousness and there is any such a thing as ascension or heaven or anything like that, wouldn't you want to get rid of the negative stuff? Wouldn't you want to get rid of the stuff that didn't work? And maybe this is a way of doing it. You know, if all those people, all those sleeping masses go off and join the mainframe and become zombies and go off and do something else, well, maybe it'll leave the world free for us. I mean, you know, maybe we can have a better world. There's all sorts of different ways of looking at it. But I don't think they're going to get away with what they're doing. I really don't. I think the human spirit is too powerful. And it's been kind of liberating being kicked off YouTube in a way. I don't have to worry about what I say anymore. I mean, it's kind of sad in some ways, but all that work still exists. There's a website called altcensored.com that managed to grab my entire YouTube channel when they deleted it, so it's still there on altcensored.com. So you can still get the information. And thanks for having me on, Richie. And, yeah, we'll have to do it a little bit more regularly. And thanks for still doing what you do too, brother. I mean, your voice is needed in the UK. And we are really heading for those serious times that we knew were coming. I've said to people so often, there's a train coming, and when it hits, it will be sudden, there will be no warning, and it has certainly hit. And as you were saying, the ride has just about started, just about to begin. We've just reached the top of the ramp, and the roller coaster ride is just about to begin, so hang on to your hats.
And the result,
I'll see on the other side.
See on the other side. The result is not predetermined, hopefully.
Well, that's another question that Richie Allen just slips in at the end. I hope the result is not predetermined. Well, I suppose there's everything to play for, Martin, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, this is the biggest inflection point since World War II. And, of course, if you remember, 2020 began with Trump assassinating Soleimani, which nearly set off a war in the Middle East. People have forgotten all about that. I mean, perhaps we're going to be moving on to talk about war in the Caucasus. You know, the banks were bailed out again.
Can I just pin you down to this idea though of the roller coaster? We're about to set off down the roller coaster. What advice have you got for people that want to survive at the end of the roller coaster?
Well, I think the fact is that all of these, you know, we've got a generalized crisis of capitalist civilization, and this pandemic really is. As you say, as people are saying, it doesn't actually kill that many people compared to previous pandemics, but what it has certainly done...
Well, flus.
Well, yeah, but what it has certainly done is it's created a situation where the banks have been bailed out yet again. And, of course, most people have failed to recognise that
that's not advice for people, is it? What advice have you got for people that want to come out of this?
Well, you've got, basically...
Survive it.
We've got, basically, human solidarity requires us to work with others, because there isn't an individual solution.
At social distance?
Well, if necessary,
or
yes.
Or on Zoom?
If necessary, you've got to do what you've got to do.
It's interesting, isn't it, the way that this Zoom has been used to get what would be basically private meetings under surveillance. I mean, in fact, there's been several occasions now where information has been compromised because it's been on Zoom. I think you were chatting last week to me after the show about the Green Party dobbing in one of the Extinction Rebellion activists because he's sitting there on Zoom and they could watch it and see it and record it, what he was saying and doing. And so he's now been arrested by the police. I think he's been released last week, actually. Paul Mobbs was telling me this sort of situation it's not very good having a private meeting on Zoom. In fact, it's impossible.
Yeah, but it's not just a kind of question of, you know, people in the, relatively privileged people in the West losing their rights. We've been basically having a war on the poor in poor countries has been going on for quite a long time. We invaded Iraq in 2003 and we probably directly led to the death of millions of
people.
We
need to level down to the sorts of rights that we've got in China and India from
the
UK, do we?
No, I'm just saying that it's not just about the pandemic and it's not just about people's rights to go to the shops or whatever it is. We've got fundamental problems underlying the whole system. 9/11 was an inside job carried out from inside the Western security force. resources, and the banks were bailed out when they shouldn't have been, and have been bailed out again last year.
I'm still waiting for your advice. What's your advice to people to survive this?
The advice is get organised with other people, basically, okay. And talk to people, get organised, because ultimately we're going to fight in large groups, aren't we?
Well, hopefully at social distance. Africa's free, apparently, of wild polio. This is our last clip from Prime Minister's Questions this week. But just have a listen to this, because it's wild polio is the word that's used, and most people would think, well, that's fine. But they don't talk about Bill Gates's vaccine-induced polio at all in this clip.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Rotary Club of Loughborough Beacon would like to pass on their thanks to the UK Government for being one of the top donors to the Global Polio Eradication Initiative, which has made Africa free from wild polio. Will the Prime Minister join me in congratulating Rotary and their supporters for their own monumental contribution to this effort, contributing over $2 billion and helping to vaccinate over 2.5 billion children around the world?
Well, I thank my honourable friend, because that is a classic and a fine example of the philanthropy and public spirit of the British people, which has been shown clearly throughout this crisis.
But more than a dozen African countries right now, Martin, are battling outbreaks of polio caused by the vaccine in countries like Angola, Congo, Nigeria and Zambia. So they're using that word wild polio is very mendacious, really, literally extremely deceptive. Maybe she's just working for Big Pharma.
Well, I think we're at one on this. Big Pharma are basically a cartel of evil. And the idea that what they're doing and what Bill Gates is doing is helping people to as I said on the show the other week, the main killer in Africa is diarrhea, and it's just to do with dirty water.
Can we just talk about this for a minute? Because polio outbreaks in Africa, and this is in The Guardian, are caused by mutations of a strain in the vaccine. But she's not talking about that at all, so she's basically...
No, in other words, we it's just rah, 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 isn't it wonderful what we've all done to save the Africans from polio. Meanwhile, of course, the vaccine itself is spreading polio, and of course the real problem in Africa isn't polio anyway, it's diarrhea, and that's just caused by poverty and lack of clean
water. Why aren't we locked down, walking down over a diarrhoea then?
Well, what we need to do, but we're not, the
why
whole,
isn't Africa
the whole
locking
question,
down over it?
Well, because it's not, locking down wouldn't help you with diarrhoea, would it? It's not really relevant. The problem is that our perceptions of what's going on in the world and what the serious problems are, it's what Brian Eno calls proper gender. That means that this is what we want to talk about. We want to talk about polio. But in actual fact, the real problem is diarrhea. And also things like lack of access to land, international debt. Every African countries collect taxes, and all that money is sent straight to the City of London to be recycled in the housing market and turned into our conservatories. That's what really puts them down.
Fox News this week, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, Hong Kong virologist Dr. Li Meng Yan, she is saying that she worked in the Wuhan labs, and she's a whistleblower now. She's saying that it's definitely China that produced this virus. Before we hear from her, Martin, what do you make of that?
Well, I've been reading about her, and in actual fact, people from the Hong Kong University where she's based are saying, well, she didn't, in fact, she's not, in fact, done the things she said she'd done. In any case, the Wuhan laboratory...
Well, the Chinese would say that, wouldn't
they?
Yes,
they would. The Wuhan laboratory was actually... quite a lot of investment went into that from DARPA, which is actually the Pentagon.
The Pentagon, yeah.
Yeah. So, in other words, even if it did leak from that laboratory, it's quite possibly a deliberate leak by the Pentagon to destroy the Chinese economy. Because we're having a trade war with China.
Well, it wouldn't just destroy the Chinese economy, it's just destroy the world economy.
Indeed. What it does is it allows them to bail the banks out.
You're absolutely right. $2 trillion. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Hong Kong virologist Dr. Li Meng Yan on Fox News.
This virus, COVID-19 SARS-CoV-2 virus, actually is not from nature. It is a man-made virus created in the lab based on the China military discover and owned the very unique bat coronavirus, which cannot affect people, but after the modification, becomes a very harmful virus as now. So I have evidence to show why they can do it, what they have done, how did they do it. Why there is nobody want to see it, it's because of the big suppression come from the Chinese Communist Party government and also their friend in scientific world. So basically, this is very clearly that this virus is like Frankenstein. So he created those things like basically a cow has deer's head, has rabbit's ear, and also have monkey's hand. So they can never get it from the nature. And there were evidence left in the genome. But the scientific world also keeps silence, work together with Chinese Communist Party. They don't want the people to know this truth. Also, that's why I get suspended, I get suppression. I am the target that Chinese Communist Party want to be disappeared.
So the key thing she's saying there is, Martin, that this is definitely China that's done this. And she reckons that she's got the why, what and the how of it, how it all happened on this. What's a gain of function is what they call it, isn't it? The changing a bat virus into a human virus. But she's saying it's like a kind of Frankenstein thing. But actually, it's not really like that, is it? I mean, it's just a virus which will affect one thing or another. It's not actually taking bits from all sorts of animals and making an animal. It's a virus, and it's, you know, it will only affect certain proteins in that virus, will affect other things. But anyway, what do you make of her statement? I mean, she does come across as quite a genuine whistleblower.
Yeah, well, various people have said that I've been reading and saying that in actual fact she's very close to billionaires who are very anti the Chinese Communist Party. And I think that she is probably the source that Bannon was saying, we're going to prove that the Chinese did this. So they're not just saying that the Chinese leaked it by accident. These people are saying they did it deliberately. So I just don't think that makes any sense. The Chinese are not going to deliberately leak a virus into their own industrial heartland in order to try and create problems for Donald Trump. That doesn't make sense at all, does it? I think what's happened here is because we had the swine flu epidemic in China, which killed off their pigs. They had the bird flu, which killed off their chickens. And of course, this basically trade war has been declared on China because they're about to take over from the US in various ways, and they've got to be got now. And makes much more sense that this is actually a biological warfare attack on China because of the Wuhan military games gave them an opportunity to do it. Don't forget that DARPA were also invested in this Wuhan center because it was so
in other Pentagon
words,
money there. Yeah,
Pentagon money. So in other words, that if they're on
it
the
could
inside,
be either side. If really, yeah, isn't that the honest way to say it? It could be either side,
but it wouldn't make sense for the Chinese to do it deliberately to themselves. If they were going to leak a virus, they'd leak it in the United States.
And also,
they?
Which of the Chinese or the United States has been the most fascistic and aggressive around the world, mimicking the behaviour of Nazi Germany in the 30s? Is it China or the US?
Well, indeed. And of course, we know that Fort Detrick was the source of the anthrax, which was used to
intimidate.
Quite possible. Larry Romanoff, who's based in Shanghai, thinks that what may have happened is it leaked from Fort Detrick last year. And of course, the Wuhan Games, the military that went to the Wuhan military games, they trained very near Fort Detrick. And that they could have transferred
by accident.
Well, we don't know. I suspect if it is a biological warfare agent, and it's not designed to kill loads of people, it's designed to mess up the economy. I think it's a biological warfare attack on the Chinese. Chinese intelligence services worked out what was going on and jumped on it. And then, of course, they allowed it to flow back over the West because they need an excuse to bail the banks out. They were bailing the banks out in September
before
this kicks in.
The real agenda to me seems to be to do with the idea of trying to get mandatory vaccinations. And, of course, this has been happening, hasn't it? I mean, we reported, I think it was on the German idea of mandating vaccines last year, Martin. So it's not as if this has not been talked about before all this happened.
They are talking about mandatory vaccines.
No, they have mandated vaccines in China, by the way. Yeah. Do you know when they mandated vaccines in China?
I've no idea, Tony.
Have a guess.
What do you mean by mandated vaccines?
Well, it's a law that you have to take the vaccine.
Not a vaccine for COVID, because there ain't one.
No, we're talking about general vaccine mandatory legislation.
I can imagine that they probably did that from very early in the regime.
No, August 2019. According to the law, China is to implement the state immunisation programme. That happened in August last year. Germany is also mandated. That was on the 1st of March.
These aren't COVID, though, are they?
This is mandatory
vaccines for other things.
That's right. But it's all just happened just before this pandemic. So Germany introduced a law mandating vaccines in schools on the 1st of March 2020. Actually, whilst this was all known about, measles vaccinations in Germany are required to register in schools. Parents are fined thousands of euros if they violate the law. So it's a mandatory vaccine in actually many countries. So in Germany this happened. Actually, I'll put a link up to the article on Vox all about the mandatory vaccine program that's been happening late last year and early this year, which does suggest there's some sort of prediction that something like this might happen so that they can just force people to have vaccines. Italy's parliament passed a law that makes 10 childhood vaccines mandatory for children up to the age of 16 and requires parents at any time to prove that their children have been immunised before they're allowed to go to school. In France, the health ministry has made 11 vaccines, up from the current 3 mandatory for children, although there's no talk of any fines yet in France. So at least the French have been a little bit sensible about this. And in New South Wales in Australia, they passed a no jab, no play legislation in September 2017. The law bans unvaccinated children from going to preschool and daycare. And in New York City, actually in New York State, in the United States, where there was a measles outbreak a year ago, the government has threatened parents that don't vaccinate their children with a fine of up to £1,000. Anyway, that's quite an interesting compilation of all these. Well, the first one there you heard was September 2017. But the big one, of course, was China with a massive mandatory vaccination program brought in August last year. This year, the Germans bringing it in March, Martin, and there are many medical professionals in Germany totally against it, but the German government did it anyway before the main part of the pandemic actually hit.
Well, as you say, Tony, it's not actually to do with the pandemic anyway.
Well, it is. Yeah, I would suggest it is. It's not a coincidence that we've got all these mandatory vaccination programs and there just happens to be a mass pandemic, which isn't a pandemic, by the way.
Well,
in fact, the World Health Organization have completely changed their rules about what is a pandemic. You can have a pandemic if there's lots of positive cases, even if there's no one ill.
All right. Let's come back to China. The Chinese have mandated the vaccines, but these vaccines will not be provided by Western pharmaceutical companies.
So why did they do it in August 2019? Did they know something was coming?
Maybe, Tony, I don't know. But the point I'm making about this is that the Chinese vaccines will be provided by the Chinese government, not by Big Pharma in the West. So the conspiracy theory, which runs that this is all to do with making money for Big Pharma in the West, the Sputnik V vaccine, which has been developed by the Russians,
it might be all to do with COVID. The more sensible conspiracy theory that this is just an attempt to control the entire Western population and bring about a similar situation to what they've got in China with the social credit system, where unless you've had a vaccine, you're not allowed to live a normal life, that you're basically an untouchable citizen.
But that then implies that both the Chinese and the Big Pharma in the West are on the same side, which I don't think is the case.
Well, why not? Why not? We've got all sorts of figures like Henry Kissinger. They've got fingers in both pies.
Let's come back to this Russian vaccine, the Sputnik V vaccine, which they've developed. It was developed in Russian public sector laboratories. And the response of the Americans was to sanction those laboratories.
No, absolutely potty. And surely, you know, it should be up to doctors and individuals, if they want a vaccine, to choose which one they have. But of course, in the current situation, even with the MMR jabs, you're not allowed to do that. You've got to have the MMR jab for your children. You're not allowed to have a measles and mumps and rubella vaccine separately. You've got to have them all together, which is one of the reasons why a lot of the people have been very critical of the pharmaceutical industry and the medical profession in this country, because they believe that combining the three vaccines, and it makes a lot of sense to me, is more dangerous than having them separately. Anyway, on the subject of vaccines, I went back to someone called Julie Beale, who we interviewed on the Dialect show, gosh, must be about 4 or 5 years ago now, about something called, what she called Global Smart ID. She writes for something called Activist Post, and I've seen a couple of her articles on there over the years. I just think that she makes a hell of a lot of sense in what she's saying. Back in those days, she was saying, well, look, you know, there's going to be some kind of digital ID that people will have to have. Now, we've seen that, of course, rolling out with Bill Gates proposing this ID 2020, an ID card, an ID system, a personal digital ID, which will allow you to go back to normal once you've had a vaccine. So anyway, I asked Julie Beale, because she's been having a very good look at these different types of vaccines, as what these, and she calls them, because she's absolutely adamant that these are not vaccines. This is not something new is being done. They should give it a completely different name, because they've not just taken some sort of pathogen and maybe crippled it a little bit, or maybe, you know, like the original idea of injecting cowpox into someone to stop them getting smallpox. This is a whole new step up from that, with gene altering vaccines and that sort of thing. So and she calls them the Ronavaxes, which I rather like, and she calls it the Rona scam, and these are new words that she's introducing in order to try and get people to understand that this is not any normal vaccine at all they're developing.
So they've got three vectors, which is a delivery vehicle that they wrap up the genes or the genetic code in. One of them is an adenovirus, never been licensed. The other is nanoparticles for mRNA, neither of which have ever been licensed. And the other is a DNA bacterial plasmid, followed by electroporation, which I can explain, and that's being used by Inovio, amongst some other companies, but I'm only talking about the front runners.
And I guess the idea
hang here... Hang on a minute, Tony. No? You say next generation, how long do you think they've been in development for? Just out of interest, I thought...
Okay, well, I'm going to guess, because I know a bit about the CRISPR vaccines, I would say something like 10 years.
31 years. 31, the first gene therapy trial.
A long time. Now, the obvious question here is, maybe that these things weren't safe enough to use.
That's what I think. And they haven't reached phase 3 trials either. There's so many of them, Tony. There's so many.
So we reckon around about something like 25 different vaccines. Martin, the main problem here, of course, is that these are what Julie's talking about here are not the Russian vaccine at all. These are the gene snipping vaccines, which will go in and alter your DNA. Now, this all starts to sound a bit like some kind of mad transhumanist's dream rather than any kind of cure.
Yeah, well, Catherine Austin Fitz, you're probably familiar with. I mean, she says that, that a lot of what's passed off as vaccines are not, in fact, vaccines at all. That they're designed to do completely different things.
So would you agree that we should have a different name? Like she's saying Ronavax.
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on this, as she clearly is. But am I suspicious of the motives of Big Pharma in the West? Certainly I am.
Anyway, Julie's very interested in the way that you can bamboozle an entire population into believing stuff. And she's looked up stuff from the RAND Corporation and other things, talking about fire hosing. Have you heard of that, Martin?
Well, you'll have to remind me, what is fire hosing?
Well, fire hosing is where you just shower people basically with loads and loads of information, contradictory information included, so that they get completely there are techniques to get people to believe certain things that have been tried and tested. These are basically psychological mind control techniques.
Well, then, let's look at the obvious one, 9/11. Most people are still, I mean, there's lots of people who do realise that it couldn't possibly have been carried out by Muslim extremists capturing aeroplanes. But most people still believe that that was a heinous attack on the United States of America, and therefore justified their rampage around the developing world. But of course, it's clear that the Islamophobia that's been created by these incidents is enormous and real. And won't
including
go away easily.
Manchester, we were talking about earlier.
It won't go away easily, will it?
Yeah. Anyway, this is a longer clip from Julie now, where she talks about this whole idea of fire hosing and the blatant link between this plandemic, as she calls it, and the Great Reset. She said it actually, they're taking the mickey, because the Great Reset is obviously been well planned beforehand. So this seems to be a way, as you were hinting, Martin, that, you know, the idea of trying to collapse the global economy, the Great Reset is all ready to save the day.
I heard the term fire hosing. I looked it up, and, you know, there's a Wikipedia entry, but there was also, it referred to a document by the Rand Corporation and Evil Corporation. Oh, it's got to be careful using that word. But anyway, it's very valuable, and I would advise people to read it. Yes, I'm advising people to read a Rand Corporation document. It's accusing the Russians of fire hosing, which is basically an out and out, you know, just, it's basically what's being done to us now, where all forms of media are used to blast out messages of which many are confusing and disorientating to the person receiving them. But the general idea is that whatever goes in first, you know, by a kind of by a source that's seen as authoritative, becomes that person's belief, and then it becomes hard to change it. And it's saying it offers a few tips in this article about how to counter the effect of fire hosing, and it says, one thing that it doesn't really have much of an effect is the squirt gun of truth. So I realized, you know, because apparently, right, so yeah, apparently when someone has a strong belief system and you present alternative views or, you know, a set of facts to them, they will dismiss it to the point where it actually strengthens their own beliefs. So if you were to say, you know, just an out and out, no, that's absolute rubbish, I think it'd probably be better to go, yeah, I know what you mean, but hey, I am quite worried about those vaccines myself, to be honest. Did you know that they're not being licensed? Did you know that they've been around for they've been like planning those for over 30 years, but why have that never been licensed? Why doesn't the news, why don't they ever talk about those on the telly? Like, I didn't know they were going to do that. What's DNA? What's MRA? You know, I think that just instead of looking like you're trying to change someone's mind, basically, is to, and then the other thing is to try and to get to them first, like to give them information of what you think is going to be done by the fire hosing side, as it were, so that you can, so that then they're less influenced by it because they're prepared for it. Does that make sense?
I mean, yeah, it does. Yeah, I mean, you know, so the idea really being to sort of almost like second guess the other side and saying, well, they're going to try this next or they'll try that next or whatever. Which could be anything, couldn't it? I mean, it could be a terrorist attack, it could be a war, it could be a second virus.
Well, that's why I'm writing about that H1N1. It's called a G4, just if anyone's listening, G4EA, which stands for Eurasian Avian-like H1N1 Swine Flu. There you go. And I just thought it would be interesting to write an article about that and to show, like, with evidence why it is I'm suggesting it and link it to, you know, to previous false pandemics, fake pandemics. And
you also mentioned the Agenda 21, and I think there's another one, isn't there? Agenda 2030.
That's part of Agenda 21. That's like Agenda, like the 21 refers to the 21st century, and Agenda, like, so 2030 is just like a sort of milestone as part of Agenda 21. That's how that works.
Well, maybe, you know, maybe they said that, but maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was all about 2021 and the Great Reset, because it does...
Well, it has occurred to me, actually, Tony. It's just too much of a coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah, and what do you make of the Great Reset? Because that's obviously something which has been being cooked up for quite a while.
Well, I'm just surprised at how blatant they are, to be honest. But they seem to be getting away with it. Although, is that because most people haven't heard? I think if most people knew that they were starting to talk about building, well, the World Health Organization insisted that this COVID pandemic was teaching us that you know, all these things about the environment and that how we had to build back better in April. Like, it was just too early. They started like Bill Gates talking about the next pandemic when this one had just begun. It's too much for people. That's too blatant.
So there's, bless her, Julie Beale there. First time we've had her back on this programme for about 3 or 4 years, with a bang. Her article, Martin, on Activist. But Activist Post is an interesting site in that they have all sorts of nonsense mixed with brilliant stuff, which I suppose is a deliberate way of allowing people like Julie to get her stuff out, but trying to sort of toxify it with strange stories that may not be as well written and well researched. Her articles are, I'll put a link up to them on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. One of the first ones was called The Rona Scam. We need to talk about proteins, vaccines and genetic patents, is where she really starts going into these various different types of smart vaccines that they're bringing in, that she just calls it the Ronavax.
Yeah, well, we know that they've been trying to patent life forms, like Monsanto have been trying to do that for years and years and years. And, you know, the overall, you know, there is a battle plan clearly being worked out. I mean, 9/11 didn't come out, you know, that had been planned for years beforehand. It then took place and various countries were then invaded. And there's an ongoing attempt to essentially seize control of the world's resources on behalf of the Western oligarchy.
So she's written a series of articles for Activist Post. The Ronavax Rundown, a quick guide to the Ronavax and what's said to be in them. Fantastic job she's done. Imagine this is a single mum in Wales doing all this work that none of the billions and billions of pounds and dollars of mass mainstream media has bothered to do. And then also there's a guide to the Ronavax, understanding the experimental coronavirus vaccines. Gates' way to genetic control, question mark. Here comes the EA swine flu. The main selling point, she says, of GenVax is their super quick turnaround time. Just give the vax makers the genetic sequence and they can whip up a cure in no time. So she's saying this is basically the way that it's heading, is that the whole vaccine technology industry is preparing to be able to roll out new vaccines in very, very short spaces of time. And this will be the cool thing to do, will be to have the quick vaccine as soon as you can when there's another pandemic, however dangerous it is. And of course, Martin, this could be used with more serious biological weapons, couldn't it? So when a very nasty biological weapon is released, which hasn't got a death rate, which is kind of flu-like, but much, much greater, you will be seen as the cool person who has the vaccine to it as quick as possible.
Yeah, well, I think despite all of this, if this was a plandemic, as people are saying, including yourself, why, you? Well, no, I've just mentioned the word there because that's a word.
Well,
that's
you are because you're talking about this being potentially a deliberate release of a bioweapon.
Yeah,
that's a plandemic.
Well, I suppose it is. Yeah, I think the fact is that they haven't actually developed a vaccine, because it's actually not clear that you can develop the effective vaccine. I mean, the Russian Sputnik 5 vaccine is still being tested. And, of course, you know, it's still not ready to be used on a wide scale.
And she's talking about deaths of people who've been involved in trials of these Ronavaxes, similar things. Anyway, Jesse Gelsinger and Asani De Silva, various people who put themselves forward for these testing, and something called the Tegenero incident. And also she's talking about the World Health Organization being in charge of biodiversity, messing with DNA in many, many ways. It's been scuppered thus far by the Convention on Biodiversity. But the World Health Organization is trying to change all that in order to take over this global regulator. And what she says also calls protein shame, the darkest side of biotech, the rise of so-called therapeutics and food based on proteins. So this is Bill Gates' territory too, isn't it? The idea of growing food in laboratories rather than on fields.
Yeah, and of course it's based on the fundamental misapprehension that the problem we've got is a problem of lack of food. In actual fact, there's plenty of food, it's just that poor people can't afford to buy it because they've got no access to land and all the other things.
And money.
Yeah, well that's... It's basically social injustice. I mean, Amartya Sen, the economist in Indian economist, pointed out years ago that ultimately the real problem is political injustice. That's what kills people.
Her final article is about Ronavax, understanding synthetic biology and XNA, which scientists also call alien DNA, because it's not, inverted commas, of this world, and the potential reprogramming of our physical reality, plus a look at the use of XNA in gene therapy. For example, the mRNA used in the Ronavax is almost real, but not quite. It uses nucleotide analogues for parts of the code that's created. There's also a push to use XNA as a genetic firewall against viruses. As it said, this would be safer than using Gentech based purely on natural DNA. So, I mean, she really has gone into this, Martin, in a way that I was very pleased to interview her, whether it was 4 or 5 years ago, because she was really showing, I think, a fascinating insight into this whole idea of get everyone on the planet being given digital identification that they could use on computers and going into buildings, etc. But she's done a particularly good job, I think, what she said to me was that she was spending quite a lot of her time during the lockdown looking into all these potential vaccines and viruses. She's done, I think, an excellent job in doing. Why is it the mainstream media can't basically do this, look into all these technologies that are about to be rolled out? I suppose it's because then people might not want to actually have anything to do with them if they knew what they were.
Well, the fact is, as you well know, Tony, that most corporate media is there to sell stuff that the advertisers want to be sold and to follow the line taken by the people who own the media that we're talking about. So, you know, Noam Chomsky pointed this out years ago, you know. I mean, basically, it's not that the individuals, journalists, for example, are corrupt. It's just that if they weren't corrupt, they wouldn't be there. They've got to be, you know, they've got to go along with what everybody else goes along
with. So you'll find Julie on
otherwise they won't have a job, will
they? Activist Post, and one of her articles anyway is called We Need to Talk About Proteins, the Rona Scam, the Vaccines, and the Genetic Patents. Some of her work possibly might be on lockdown skeptics. I'm not absolutely sure about that. It might be, but it might not be. Another thing that's come up, Martin, to do with COVID this week is the suspension from Twitter of one of the Telegraph columnists. I'm not sure if you'd seen anything about that, have you?
I think I did pick up something about
Alison
it.
Pearson is her name. In a response to Let Another We're All Doomed report on the BBC News, how hard is it, she said, for people to understand? We want students to get the virus, she says. They will speed us towards community immunity. And it may be not very far away. So she's saying that actually it could be really good for students to all get together. But this view, it's a legitimate scientific view. Many scientists are saying this too, not all scientists. But she's being told both by the mass media, we're not interested in you, although the Telegraph has printed her column, the rest of it isn't. And on Twitter have decided to ban her for saying that, which is something which many scientists have said too. So this debate has been shut down.
Well, she wasn't shut down in the Telegraph, as you just pointed out. Twitter have banned her, but then Twitter, just like the Telegraph, is a private organisation, and they're under no obligation.
And well, these big pharma companies are very, right. These big pharma companies are very closely connected to big tech, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. So, in other words, unless you were going to have sort of Ofcom rules for everybody, as it were, people are, you know, these tech platforms, which have been encouraged by the deep state in the US, are private organisations, and they're under no obligation to give people a fair hearing if they don't want to give them a fair hearing. And they don't. So don't expect you're going to get one.
Okay, and we're going to go now to look at Eastern Europe. to Belarus. And Marcus Papadopoulos, I spoke to early this week, and he has a lot to say, Martin, about Belarus history. Do you want to give us, before we hear from him, your potted history of Belarus?
Well, I've done it several weeks running. It might be more interesting to have him say something and then I can comment on it.
Well, you could have done it in the amount of time that you said that. All right, anyway, let's have a bit of Belarus history from Marcus Papadopoulos. Well, in a nutshell, means short.
The Soviet Union was not a prison of peoples, as is alleged by British and American politicians and journalists. In March 1991, Mikhail Gorbachev held a referendum in the Soviet Union in which the Soviet people were asked, do they wish to preserve the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics? 76% of the Soviet people chose to vote in the affirmative, namely to preserve the USSR. So that on its own demonstrates that the Soviet Union was not a prison of peoples. And in Belarus, the percentage of people who voted to preserve the USSR was in excess of 80%. Now, Belarus, or to give it its proper historical name, Belorussia, meaning White Russia, has been led by Alexander Lukashenko since 1994. Alexander Lukashenko is an authoritarian leader, but that is in the DNA of all Russian leaders. Belarusia, we're talking about the same people. Belarusians are Russians. Belarusia and Russia have to be run in an authoritarian manner. That might not be to the taste of people in Britain and America, but when Russia is led by weak individuals such as Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin, the country collapses. Now, Alexander Lukashenko prevented the catastrophe which befell Russia in the 1990s from striking in Belarus, because he ensured that the Belarusian economy would be, largely speaking, a state-run economy. He did not allow privatization, in particular shock therapy, to come about in Belarus in the 1990s, and he prevented the emergence of oligarchs. So because of that, Alexander Lukashenko, from 1994 to the present, is a genuinely popular leader. He ensures that Belarus has one of the most stable of societies in Europe. People there all have jobs. They all have homes. There is no homelessness. There is barely any crime. People are paid their salaries on time. People are paid pensions. The healthcare is free and excellent. Transportation is very, very affordable and is excellent. So Alexander Lukashenko has been re-elected as president for all these years now because he's genuinely popular amongst the Belarusian people. America and Britain are not sincere when they say they are committed to democracy and human rights. That is simply an untenable argument for anyone to make. If America and Britain were genuinely committed to those concepts, then they would not have strategic partnerships with some of the most appalling, some of the most wicked of countries in the world, such as Saudi Arabia. No. What the West, Britain and America, have been doing in on the territory of the former Soviet Union for nearly 20 years now, or what Russia calls the near abroad, is orchestrating a number of coups in order to weaken Russia's position on the territory of the former Soviet Union. The near abroad is the number one priority for Russian foreign policy. If Russia loses its predominant position in the near abroad, then Russia has no hope whatsoever of being a superpower. That is why, after Vladimir Putin came to the helm of power in Russia, he dictated that the number one foreign policy objective for Russia would be to secure the near abroad. And Russia today, with the exception of the Baltic states and Ukraine, is the predominant outside force in Belarus, in the South Caucasus, and in Central Asia. But nonetheless, the West have been successful in bringing about coups in the former Soviet Union. So we had the coup in Georgia in 2003. We had the coup in Ukraine in 2004. We had a coup in Kyrgyzstan in 2005. And most notably of all, the coup in Ukraine in 2014. What the West called the Orange Revolution, they call them the Color Revolution. So you have the West talks about a rose revolution, a tulip revolution, then an orange revolution. But in reality, these so-called color revolutions in the former Soviet Union have been simply coups organized by Washington and London. Now, the orange revolution, which brought Viktor Yushchenko to power at the beginning of 2005, failed because Viktor Yanukovych, who was more at one with Russia, came to power 5 years later in 2010. But then the West struck back in Ukraine at the beginning of 2014. And they have been successful because the West, because Ukraine is now integrating with the West politically, economically, culturally, and militarily. And this
West have been biding its time, really, even a decade after the first attempt at the coup.
Yes.
There was then a successful one.
Absolutely. They learnt their mistakes following the coming to power of their man, Viktor Yushchenko, in 2005. And we have to remember that the British and the Americans are extremely patient people. They are masters of propaganda. They are masters of strategy, and they are absolutely determined to weaken Russia in its backyard, so to speak. But their attempt to instigate a coup in Belarus, I should really call it Belarussia, has failed, and it was destined to fail.
Well, that's a pretty, I used to work in Eastern Europe during the 90s, as you know, and that's a pretty fair assessment of what's happened. And not much to disagree with there.
What about this whole idea of this series of coups, Georgia, Ukraine, and the failed coup in Ukraine, but then that was successful in 2014?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's not just in Eastern Europe and Russia. I mean, they do the same sort of thing in the Middle East and Latin America. So, this colour
revolution. So Venezuela is a similar.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, the one of the first successful colour revolutions was in Serbia, where, you know, they basically got, you know, they've developed, it's very much associated with the democratic wing of
So how
of
do they
US
get all
capitalism.
These people to come out on the streets and demonstrate then?
Well, because there's usually reasons for people to be discontented with local
politics. I suppose it's
politics.
Whether they're organised or not, isn't it?
Yeah.
And who's
and course,
doing the organising
yeah,
of those people.
What you do is you create, I mean, in 1989, when these various dominoes collapsed, there was a very interesting BBC Two documentary about what really happened in 1989. And in actual fact, Gorbachev basically set the KGB to undermine the East European communist dictatorships. And so one of the things the KGB did in Czechoslovakia, for example, was that they encouraged students to go out in the street to protest against the government, and then they let the police beat the students up. They made sure that went out on national TV, and then it creates a situation where the government's forced
out. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because
so that was a colour revolution run by the KGB in Eastern Europe. In fact, most of the revolutions in Eastern Europe were not entirely spontaneous.
I'm laughing is
they were run by the KGB.
It's because, like Keir Starmer and many others, Gorbachev was a member of the Trilateral Commission, wasn't he? Not a bit. I mean, this is like one tier down at the deep state from the Bilderberg.
Yeah, I mean, Gorbachev, I think, was quite genuine in his desire to try and reform the system that he'd inherited. He was very, very naive about the kind of people he was working with in the West, who really didn't have the best interests of anybody in Eastern Europe at heart, and they still don't.
Anyway, Marcus Papadopoulos is the editor of Politics Home. The next clip we've got from him is about Nagorno-Karabakh.
Nagorno-Karabakh is a disputed territory. De jure, it's part of Azerbaijan. De facto, it is ruled by Armenia.
And of course, fighting has broken out.
It is mainly populated by Armenians. But in Soviet times, it was a part of what was then known as the Azerbaijan SSR, Azerbaijan Soviet Socialist Republic.
Well, you know what? This reminds me very much of the context of the Crimea because again, under the Soviet leadership, there were quite a lot of important boundary changes,
yes,
which then sealed off particular ethnic groups from their natural home. Yes. Well, that didn't matter too much when you were within one enormous great Soviet republic.
Yes.
Now things,
yes,
are starting to break up. That,
yes,
is enormously important. I wonder if you think that might be playing a role here.
Yes, absolutely. You know, map making, internal borders was something that was the brainchild of Lenin and was something that was opposed by Stalin. Stalin didn't want Soviet Russia to be called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. He wanted it to simply be called the Russian Federation. But of course, Lenin was in power and Lenin naturally had his way. And at one stage in the 1920s and early 1930s, the South Caucasus and parts of the North Caucasus was called Transcaucasia. But then they started to create Azerbaijan, Georgia, and then Armenia, and then you had these autonomous republics within the Russian Soviet Federal Socialist Republics, such as Chechnya, Dagestan, Ingushetia. But as you correctly said, Tony, those internal borders didn't mean anything in practice because the Soviet Union was a country. But of course, once the Soviet Union was dissolved, then those internal borders became overnight international borders. But what we've seen with Nagorno-Karabakh is a flare-up in violence. It's not a war. The chances of it breaking out into a war are very, very minimal because Russia has tremendous influence in Armenia and Azerbaijan. Both countries are in Russia's orbit, and indeed Azerbaijan in recent years has drifted further and further into Russia's orbit. So the chances of a war are very, very unlikely. There are flare-ups in violence over Nagorno-Karabakh between the Armenians and the Azerbaijanis. There was a flare-up in 2016. Russia will not allow a war to break out as a war broke out in the early 1990s, because a war in the South Caucasus could destabilize the North Caucasus, which is in the Russian Federation. And I've always described, Tony, the North Caucasus as Russia's Achilles heel. At the moment, there is peace there. There is stability there with Chechnya, Ingushetia and Dagestan. But it is still quite a delicate region. And if there was an eruption of a full-blown war in the South Caucasus, that could very easily spill over into the North Caucasus in Russia. So that is another reason why Russia simply will not allow a war to break out between Armenia and Azerbaijan over Nagorno-Karabakh. Russia and Turkey are traditional adversaries. A lot of commentators misunderstand the relationship today between Moscow and Ankara. They believe it is a relationship of affinity. You know, far from it. There is a mutual distrust. There is a mutual loathing between the Russians and the Turks. Both are regional rivals. During the 1990s, Turkey attempted to weaken Russia's position in the region, namely in the North Caucasus, by supporting Chechen militants of the nationalist kind and then of the Islamist kind. And likewise, Russia has attempted to weaken Turkey's position by having a long-standing relationship with the PKK. Russia provides political support for the PKK, provides logistical support, and provides weaponry to the PKK. Turkey has a very cordial relationship with Azerbaijan. The Azerbaijanis, largely speaking, are a Turkic people. And Turkey certainly has encouraged Azerbaijan to take military action against the Armenian military in Nagorno-Karabakh. And I believe, Tony, that Turkey is attempting to weaken Russia's hand in northwestern Syria, which is controlled by the Turks and Al-Qaeda. They're trying to weaken Russia's position there by trying to instigate a full-blown war in Russia's orbit. Because if a full-blown war did erupt between Armenia and Azerbaijan over Nagorno-Karabakh, and if it did spill into the North Caucasus, then of course Russia would be distracted from what's going on in Syria and would have to focus on solving the situation in the South Caucasus and also in the North Caucasus. So what we are seeing is a continuation of Russian-Turkish rivalry.
I think he makes some pretty terrific points there, actually, Martin. The idea, I didn't realise, of course, that there was all this background with the Turks supporting the Chechens against the Russians. I quite like what he says about this relationship between Russia and Turkey is of mutual loathing.
Well, historically, that's been the case. I mean, the Russian Empire before the Bolshevik Revolution, the Turks and the Russians were very, very big rivals.
But he's talking about the mid-1990s.
Yeah, well, they still are.
About his main reason there for this Nagorno-Karabakh battle? He's saying that he thinks that the Turks are encouraging it in order to bog the Russians down with that, whilst because they're getting quite annoyed that the Russians are causing trouble for them in northern Syria.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the obvious way to look at this is Turkey. Turkey's intervening in Libya. It's intervening in the Eastern Mediterranean. They're facing off with the Cypriots and the Greeks, and they're also basically fighting the Russians in Syria. So they've opened up another front here. The relationship that Russia has with Azerbaijan and Armenia is a rather hands-off relationship. They've got a military base in Azerbaijan, in Armenia. And, Azerbaijan, if you remember the Bulgarian journalist uncovered the rat line taking Bulgarian weapons to the jihadists in Syria, and it was an Azeri airline that was doing the transporting. So the Azeris, although they are Shia, are Turkic, and they're hostile to the Iranians because they've got the same, even though they're Shia, they're hostile to the Iranians, bizarrely enough. And so the Iranians tend to align with Armenia. I went to Armenia many years ago in the 90s. It was a pretty
Armenian
experience.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about your Armenian?
No, I don't want to go into the whole story of the trip. But the point is that it's basically Armenia only really exists because Russia is a kind of big brother to it. And the Armenians, of course, were nearly wiped. You know, there was massive genocide on the Armenians carried out by the Turkish army during World War One. The current government in Armenia has basically tried to align itself more with NATO, but of course, the Azerbaijanis and the Turks are more aligned with NATO, so that they're actually and the Russians basically, as far as I can see, are that everybody apart from Turkey is calling for ceasefires. The Turks are saying no, that the Azeris should liberate Nagorno Karabakh.
Just as an illustration,
everybody else is saying, "Well just
Martin,
cool it."
Just as an illustration of how basically badly resourced Armenia was. Just give us in literally 30 seconds your view of your trip on Armenia.
Well,
I
went to what used to be Leninakan Stepnakert, which is in the top, that's in the north of the country, and it was after the earthquake. The earthquake had happened several years before. And then they were trying to rebuild after the earthquake, and then the Soviet Union collapsed, and people were literally still living in lean-to shelters with no electricity or running water on the top of what used to be a city, which used to have, Armenia was one of the more developed of the Soviet republics. So it was actually quite industrialized, lots of sophisticated industry, all gone, disappeared.
What about your trip on Armenian Airways?
Well, they were very dangerous to fly with. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
You wouldn't really want to do it.
Was it a bit of a wobbly landing, a takeoff?
Well, yes, there were all sorts of things wrong with it, because what's happening at that stage is all the independent nations of the former Soviet Union all had to have their own airline. But of course, some of them really didn't have the resources necessary to run an airline.
Well, I'll leave that to our listeners' imagination. But anyway, Marcus Papadopoulos, the final clip with him is he was there on Saturday in Trafalgar Square as part of this anti-lockdown demonstration.
I believe that the pharmaceutical industry, which exerts enormous leverage over the British government and the American government, but I should reword that, Tony. The pharmaceutical industry in both America and Britain is a vital component of the American establishment and the British establishment. And I believe this is an opportunity for them to introduce vaccinations, not just obviously for influenza, but obviously for what is known as COVID-19, and to achieve an astronomical amount of money. I think that is one. I think that is one explanation, and I think it's a very, very plausible explanation. I think the other explanation is that there are forces at play in Britain and America, in the Anglo-Saxon countries, which want to introduce artificial intelligence, a dreadful invention, absolutely appalling invention, into the global economy, for it to become the dominant element in society as we know it. And all the evidence from this year points to AI emerging in that way that I believe that the powers that be in Britain and America would like it to manifest itself in. So I think those are two explanations for what we are seeing. And I no doubt as well, it's an opportunity to exert even more control over society.
Isn't it, that these issues affect many millions, tens of millions of people in the UK, so it's quite legitimate for, yes, you know, a handful of them in comparison to come out on the streets in Trafalgar Square to lobby for their retaining, yes, their freedoms against these, you know, pharmaceutical industry and artificial intelligence. So anyway, how did it go on Saturday?
I was on Trafalgar Square, Tony, and I assure you and I assure your listeners, it was a peaceful protest.
So there's Marcus Papadopoulos. I'll put the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, along with also a longer interview with the full interview with Julie Beale, we heard earlier, as well as the chap who was talking about Lloyds Bank too. We'll have all that up on the show page at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, the irony here is this week we've had Dominic Raab from the Foreign Office putting sanctions on the Belarus leaders, including the president, for police brutality, and yet there we've got the riot police storming in to shut down a demonstration on Saturday in Trafalgar Square right under his nose.
Well, yes, I hear all of that. As I understand it, the Metropolitan Police took the view that the demonstration in Trafalgar Square was breaking the, you know, six people demonstrating rule. There's going to be a demonstration, Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol at 2 p.m. on College Green this Sunday. And it'll be interesting to see what the police do, because, of course, it's a meeting of more than six people. So we'll see. I mean, and, of course, in Belarus, the people have been demonstrating, you know, of course, Lukashenko famously didn't have any kind of lockdown and very much was of the ilk of we're not going to do any of that sort of stuff here. And the demonstrators are also obviously quite clearly not taking any kind of social distancing measures. We shall see what happens.
Well, one of those who was speaking is son of David Icke, Gareth Icke. He's a bit problematic, David Icke, mainly because of his very strange links to theosophy and theosophists. He believes that the energy from the centre of the universe is channeled via the sun, and that is how it gets to Earth, and of course affects things on the Earth via the sun, beams of energy. Martin, I mean, is it strange, this the old whole idea of, I mean, you've done PPE at Oxford, theosophy, that, you know, is strange for him to
be
a
theosophist?
We didn't
study theosophy.
Didn't you?
That's not
right,
part of
okay,
it.
All right. Well, what do you make of Icke?
I think the problem with him is, you know, we're trying to talk about sensible stuff like 9/11 was an inside job, and he's away with the fairies talking about all sorts of other stuff. From my point of view, that's actually not very constructive.
Anyway, here's his son, Gareth.
Says that you've been sharing some uncomfortable facts on Facebook, sir. 8 p.m. Thursday, come to your door. Bid farewell to your freedoms with a round of applause. And while hospitals sit empty, it's tumbleweed round the clock. The only thing going viral here is going viral on TikTok. Do not resuscitate, do not resuscitate. These orders come from on high. Because the best way to protect the elderly is by allowing them to die. He can't breathe, he can't breathe. We all take the knee. Not you. Cover your face and here's a bag full of muzzles for the kiddies. What do you mean you're exempt? Do as you're told. Ah, you thought this was about health. Nah, mate, this is about control. So give us your arm and give us your vein. Because there's no human rights when you belong to the state. We've sold your body and we've sold you lies. Sold to the highest bidder, Bill Gates and his husband, I mean wife. Is this some kind of resistance, London? Is this some kind of resistance, London? Yeah, that's right. The people have risen. We reject this control. We reject this division. We are the ocean, we have the power, we are everything to which they aspire. I am you, I love you, and you are me. We are the 99%, we are humanity. And centuries from now, they will speak of this time. Not because we rolled over, but because we drew the line. The sleeping lion is stirring, it's starting to wake. And when that lion roars, checkmate. Love you.
Okay, so that's Gareth Icke, son of David Icke, speaking at Trafalgar Square last Saturday, Martin. His dad, David, spoke just after, and then the police came in and shut the whole thing down.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's quite a good performance. If I was his drama teacher, I'd probably give him a good grade for that.
He's reading it out, it's a speech. Is it, I mean, is this all genuine, or do you think it's controlled opposition?
I think I tend to the view that it is controlled opposition.
Why?
Because what happens is that instead of focusing on the things that, to my mind, really matter, like the bailout of the banks and the deep state blowing things up like in Manchester, we're all talking about something else completely.
The other thing he's saying there is that he doesn't want to be controlled by the state. Well, I would suggest actually it's big corporations and big pharma's power over the state that's the real problem. In fact, you know, to a certain extent, the state may be the only resistance that's coming up against these big pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm a libertarian to some extent, but you've got to recognise that if we're going to run human societies, there's going to have to be some kind of authority. And I say that with some reluctance, but it's the reality.
Anyway,
and of course, your Tory MP going on earlier, he doesn't want the state to do anything. So he doesn't believe that the state should or could do things, and that is the mentality.
Well, that's not what he said at all, actually. What he said was that the scientists are saying certain things, but politicians should be there to criticise them. He's arguing for these measures to be going through Parliament and being checked.
Well, no, I'm in favour of that.
Well,
but I think that
so has he got a hidden agenda then?
Well, I guess he has got a hidden agenda, which is the privatisation of the health service.
Why should these measures not go through Parliament?
I didn't disagree with that, Tony.
Well, that's what you're saying.
I'm just saying that if you look into his views and the views of Dido Harding's husband, who's a Tory MP, they want to privatise the health service. They don't believe that the state should be looking after people at all. And that is the philosophy. And I don't agree with that.
Well, I don't know if that's the philosophy of all Conservative MPs. I think that's a gross overestimate.
The right wing of the Tory party
state. This doesn't make a lot of sense. The right wing, the left wing of the Tory party, they're not all thinking the same thing. The same as the Labour Party.
There's a general, listen.
It's an attempt to sort of, I suppose, smear.
No, it's not.
Right or left. Listen, I mean, I do it when I talk about right wing Labour.
Well, but listen, we're talking about right and left because everybody kind of knows what we're talking about when we use that phraseology.
Do they? Yes. When it comes to decisions about health.
Well, do you know the history of right and left and where it came from?
Yes, it's from France, yes.
Yeah, okay.
So we use it
as a shorthand for all sorts of things.
Yes, but it's
a
very, very, I think, getting a rather tired, old-fashioned and completely useless shorthand.
I think it doesn't.
Even though I use it myself.
Well, indeed, and of course, as Gramsci pointed out, as the communist theorist years ago, he said, even the independents are actually party men. Whatever they say, but they just wish to be the leaders of parties by the grace of God and the imbecility of those who follow.
Anyway, one person that wasn't heard at the weekend, at least he was on media, but he wasn't allowed to speak, was a guy called Dr. Heike Schoening, and he is the leader of this group, Doctors of Enlightenment, over in Germany. And when he was released from Wandsworth Police Station on Sunday, this is what he had to say.
Because we will go on to tell the truth.
Yes, we will.
And we will never give in.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes.
And think of what's going on in this country. So if you don't have the right to speak out at the very place of Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park, what is this country going to? And what is the world going to? To speak out is not an offense. And even under this very doubtful laws with COVID-19, even this is not an offense. But you can see what happened yesterday on Hyde Park, on Speaker's Corner. People gathered peacefully, listened, to talk to you and to tell the truth. The truth about what's going on COVID-19. And the police came. I did not any resistance, but straight away they arrested me, handcuffed me, and took me away. I'm one of the founders of the Extra Parliamentary Committee on COVID-19. You can read this up on acu2020.org. It's translated into 10 languages. Because the parliaments of the world failed to establish a proper committee, we the citizens have got the duty to perform this. And we, in the COVID-19 Extra Parliamentary Inquiry Committee, we performed more than 20 hearings with experts, with witnesses, and I may now invite you internationally to take part of this movement on the 10th of October 2020. Save the date, 10-10-2020. We will be millions in Berlin to demonstrate for peace, for justice, that these unlawful things won't go on. And I need to emphasize for everybody who had, said before officially that he will work for the people, like the governments, like the police, like the army officers, to think of, now is the time to be brave. Now is the time to speak out. Now is the time to demonstrate that we are a family of mankind and that we are, don't let us divide. Divide not into races, like we had experience in the 30s in Germany, and not divide into so-called sick people or so-called vaccinated people here. So this is a division, and we are one family of mankind. And think what's going on. And behind all this is not a medical pandemic. We showed all the truth, yeah, all the things. And guess what? What the police sees. I have now my suitcase with me. But what they seized, my telephone, my computer, plus a book. Yeah? Coronavirus false alarm from Professor Karina Reis and Professor Suharaj Bhakti. They seized it. So you see, yeah? They are afraid. They are afraid of what? They are afraid that we are getting contact, so they seize the mobile phones. They are afraid of the books, because scientifically all facts are laid down. And the good thing is, this book is not only published in German, it's now published in English, COVID-19 False Alarm. And this book has been the number one bestseller, and hopefully this will be the same in Great Britain. So the good message to the uninformed people is that there is no medical pandemic. You don't need to be set up in fear about a deadly virus. All data shows there was no more harm than a normal flu. The data in Germany showed us, and all over the world. So we need to ask ourselves how this orchestrated pandemic could evolve. And if you just think, okay, what happened? What is the facts behind? Think of the year 2008, the financial crash. Yeah? The financial system is dominating everything. And this system crashed. And it was clear who are the perpetrators were. Where's the banks and their private owners? And did we heal the system? No, we did not. They put much more money into this insane financial system. And they bought time. Everybody told this. Well, and now we've got 2020, and it looks like they have a plan, a great reset. And this great reset, what is the title of the World Economic Forum in 2021, here, is the great reset of the financial system. So it has nothing to do with this medical thing. But who to blame to? In 2008, it was clear it was the banks and their private owners. Now, they blame a virus. A coronavirus.
So that's Heike Schoening, Martin. Dr. Heike Schoening, who was stopped from speaking on Sunday at Speaker's Corner, but he gave his little speech there. I thought it's worth hearing him because of all the stuff. And basically, he's coming around to pretty much what you were saying there, is that this is nothing to do with the virus. It's much more to do with bailing out the banks.
It is, but of course, when he's saying there is no pandemic, what was it? I would argue that it's a biological warfare attack which is designed to destroy the Chinese economy, but it failed because the Chinese intelligence services.
Well, the reason he's saying it's not a pandemic is because the World Health Organization actually changed their definition of a pandemic, because not enough people have been dying for it to be a pandemic.
Yeah, but I think there's a contradiction, isn't there? Either this is a biological weapon, which is what, the Chinese woman was arguing earlier.
If it's a biological weapon, it's not killing any more than a normal flu season.
No, but what it's designed to do is to wreck an economy, which it might have done in China.
He's a doctor,
but it
and
didn't.
You're not. If he says
no,
it's
I'm
not
an economist.
A pandemic, if he says it's not a pandemic, I am inclined to
listen to him.
Anyway, he should be heard. This is the main point, isn't it? Why is he being arrested and his phone taken off him and his computer and a book by the police?
Well, you'd have to ask the police that, but I think the problem is that we've now got a rule that you're not supposed to meet in groups of more than six. There'll be an issue with that on Sunday in Bristol when we have a Black Lives
Matter. Are you going for that?
I'm not sure whether I'm going for that.
You
actually
went to the last one, didn't
I
you?
I did,
which
yes.
Was much more.
That was loads more, yes, but there wasn't a rule of six at that stage. Anyway, I think the fundamentals are still the same. We can agree on that. The banking system is shot to pieces.
Why are the doctors being censored like him then?
He is being censored, but other doctors don't agree with his analysis. You must be aware of that.
Well, the ones that don't agree with his analysis are given as much airtime as they want.
Indeed. So, in other words,
obvious.
Yeah, but the fact is, there's no right to be heard, Tony, as you well know.
Yes, there is. Julian Assange, what about him?
Well, what about him? He's not got any right to be heard.
He doesn't have any right, no.
No, he doesn't.
Because I think he does.
What you've got is where you've got private sector control of the media, which is pretty much what we've got, then the people who own the newspapers and the television stations decide who and who is not going to speak. And that is what's supposed to happen in a free society.
On the BBC?
Well, the BBC is under a different obligation for some kind of impartiality. But certainly that's not the case for the Daily Mail,
anyway,
for example.
Yesterday on the World...
They can say what they want, whether it's true or not.
Yesterday on the World at One, we had Mayor of Preston, Mayor of Middlesbrough, Andy Preston, appeared for an interview, got to say two words and was cut off, only to be replaced by somebody... And our final item tonight, let's have a listen to him actually giving his own statement. Because obviously, once he realised he'd been cut off by the BBC, he just went onto YouTube and did his own statement about his absolute disgust about the measures that are being imposed on Middlesbrough by Boris.
The government's just made an announcement about strict measures coming into Middlesbrough and Hartlepool. I have to tell you that I think this measure has been introduced based on factual inaccuracies and a monstrous and frightening lack of communication and ignorance. I don't accept the statement at all. I don't accept the measures. We need to talk to government. They need to understand our local knowledge, expertise and ability to get things done and preserve jobs and well-being. We're really disappointed. As things stand, we defy the government and we do not accept these measures. We need to get COVID under control and we need to work with people to find a way of preserving jobs, mental health.
We went to the government with fantastic, intelligent, pragmatic proposals to keep people safe, protect our society, make sure people don't get lonely. We put 6 months of dark nights, make sure people are looked after, make sure people can mix safely. We weren't listened to. So what's been put to us now is unacceptable. I don't accept it. Obviously, if there is a law, I will follow the law and nobody should break the law. But as things stand, I do not accept these proposals. They are unnecessary. They go too far. They'll damage mental health and they'll kill viable jobs.
So that's the Mayor of Middlesbrough, Andy Preston, Martin. He's really the first, civic leader in the country to come out and say we're not having this.
Well, I think there's been discontent at every level about the centralised way in which everything has been managed and the way in which messages just change overnight with no consultation.
But there's defiance, and he's saying, anyway, this isn't law, it's guidance, and we're taking no notice of it whatsoever. He's defying the government.
Yeah, I mean, what's going to happen now is going to be a disorderly breakdown of communication and strategy in relation to what we're doing, and that's
is it the beginning of the end for Boris? Do you think?
Oh, definitely. He's a dead man walking now, quite literally.
Time to sign off. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Irish Republican, Old Labour activist Martin Summers, and thanks also very much to Dave Bazanko, studio engineer. Long show tonight. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. Like Craig Murray and many others, I'm Shadow Band on Twitter, but you'll find me, if you're lucky, at Tony Gosling. There'll be long versions of the interviews with Trevor Mealham, the Lloyds Bank victims, with also a long one with Julie Beale, who was talking about the vaccines, done a lot of work on that, and also with Marcus Papadopoulos from Politics Home, a longer interview with him on our show page too. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend, Sunday noon. We're rebroadcast on the Richie Allen stream at richieallen.co.uk. And Sunday evenings at 6 on BCFM, it's the Glorious Tunes from Danny Losh. BCFM boss Pat Hart did say this show might be back in November. But, dear listeners, don't hold your breath. And please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters go. Catch you then.
So were those who did the fighting. In World War II, the average age of the combat soldier was 26. In Vietnam, he was 19. 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 19.
The heaviest fighting of the past 2 weeks continued today, 25 miles northwest of Saigon.
I wasn't really sure what was going on.
19. In Vietnam, the combat soldier typically served a 12-month tour of duty, but was exposed to hostile fire almost every day.
700 enemy troops were killed last week in that sensitive border area. Throughout all of South Vietnam, the enemy lost a total of 2,689 soldiers.
I wasn't really sure what was going on.